It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. Great panel for you. Mark Spoonhour joins us for the first time. He's editor-in-chief at Tom's Hardware and Laptop Magazine. Jill Duffy's back from PC Magazine. Devinder Hardawar from Engadget. We're going to, of course, talk about net neutrality and what you can do to fight the good fight. Some amazing sale deals for Black Friday. But here comes Cyber Monday, and our panel has some good picks for you, including websites that'll help you get the best price. Why Google's hardware is turning out to be so awful, and Elon's promises. Is he asking too much of the technology? It's all coming up next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 642, recorded Sunday, November 26th, 2017. Grandpa's Hairy Thumb. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Check out this week's menu and get $30 off your first delivery with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/TWiT. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/TWiT2. And by Molecule. Molecule is the world's first molecular air purifier that reduces symptoms for allergy and asthma sufferers. For $75 off your first order, visit molecule.com, that's molecule with a K, and enter the promo code TWIT. And by Fracture. Fracture is a photo decor company that prints your photos directly onto glass, then delivers them to your door ready to display right out of the box. Visit fracture.me and use the code TWIT15 at checkout to get 15% off your first order. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we get together with some of the smartest people in tech journalism, and we talk about the big stories of the week. Got a great panel for you. Devinder Hardawar is here, senior editor of Engadget. Always good to have you, Devinder.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Also a podcast maven of his own with Slash Film. And you do other shows, too, I didn't realize.
I do Slash Film. That's our main podcast. I occasionally do something with Engadget. We're still trying to figure out our podcast strategy, honestly.
You're not alone. I'm still trying to figure out my podcast strategy. Mm-hmm. Also, Jill Duffy, who is a contributing editor at PC Mag, and always a welcome guest on the show. It's great to see you, Jill. We were talking about you're only for a few more months in the U.S., and then you were in Japan for a long time.
Oh, India.
India, I'm sorry. And now you're going to Romania. This is, what a life.
Nice. It's pretty fun.
Nice to see you. And I'm going to ask you later on, because you're learning Romanian, about the various PC language tools, because there's so many of them.
Okay.
Mark Spoonhour is new. We got to welcome a newbie. He is editor-in-chief of Tom's Guide. Great to see you, Mark. Laptop Magazine.
Thanks for having me.
It's nice to have you. And don't be put off by the other people on the panel. I know they all look very mysterious and interesting, and you and I are just normal guys, but that's okay. We have a role to play as well. I guess we should start off talking about net neutrality. Do you feel like this is just the endless battle? Ajit Pai at the FCC, in a stealthy Thanksgiving release, released the new plan to basically eliminate net neutrality. Pai says, we're not going to micromanage the internet anymore. We're going back to the way it was in the good old days 2 years ago before the Obama-era net neutrality regulations. Remember, Tom Wheeler, his predecessor at the FCC, used the Telecommunications Act, Title II of the Telecommunications Act, which the courts told him he had to. It was the only powers that the FCC had to enforce net neutrality. It's a complete step back, even to the point where the FCC is saying the states may not make their own rules. This is the law of the land. We know why net neutrality is important, right? Anybody who watches this show understands. This show wouldn't exist if it weren't for net neutrality. Comcast could throttle us and say, no, you have to listen to, the guys who pay us to be speedy. Verizon would do the same thing. Tim Wu, writing in the New York Times today, says it's going to come down to the courts. And he mentions something that comes up a lot when we're talking net neutrality. A 2005 case, a small phone company in North Carolina named Madison River, they blocked Vonage because they were a phone company and Vonage was a VoIP company. That was anti-competitive. Consumers complained. Michael Powell, the chairman of the FCC at the time, fined the company and forced it to stop blocking Vonage. Tim Wu says, of course, what's going to happen is the ban on blocking is going to end, that any ISP can do anything they want, provided they're transparent about it. Madison River could block Vonage as long as they disclose the blocking on a publicly available website. And the FCC will no longer be in charge of enforcement. The Federal Trade Commission, which has very little expertise in telecommunications and is overburdened with all sorts of other things, will be in charge. Tim thinks that the courts might have a shot at that. He says Mr. Pai faces a serious legal problem. Because he's killing net neutrality outright, not merely weakening it, he will have to explain to a court not just the shift from 2015, but his reasoning for destroying the basic bans on blocking and throttling, which had been in effect since that 2005 decision and have been relied on extensively by the entire internet ecosystem. Mark, since you're new, let me give you a chance to weigh in on this. What do you think?
Sure. Well, I think part of the danger is what their argument rests on, and that's how everything is classified. So do you classify the internet as an information service or as a telecommunication service? And I think those who don't want to see things changed and go backwards really believe that the internet is a telecommunication service. And those who are saying that it's all about information are saying that just because your information is cached, just briefly, that we're able to just reclassify the internet and are basically able to kill net neutrality. So I think that actually could come back to haunt this case, and it's certainly one of the legal challenges that should be taken up.
There's no question that Google is an information service, but net neutrality doesn't regulate Google. It regulates the telecommunications companies like Verizon and Comcast that transmit unchanged the content from Google. But you're saying that the FCC essentially wants to treat them like an information service, not like a telecommunications service.
Yeah, and I'm not sure it's a very strong argument either.
Yeah, in fact, I've seen articles that say that's a fundamental misunderstanding of how the internet works.
It's a series of tubes.
But I don't think that you can blame this on misunderstanding. I think it's pretty clear that the FCC is doing the bidding of the telecommunications companies who pay a lot of money. Devinder, you have a thought?
I mean, it's pretty clear. I think like a lot of things we're seeing in this administration, a lot of it's about dismantling the protections we've built up for consumers and against certain business practices over the past couple of years. So, yeah, it's not too surprising. And I'm definitely, I think Tim Wu would have a good sense of, you know, how we could fight back against this.
He's the guy who coined the term net neutrality, by the way.
Definitely.
I give him credit, but also blame, because it's the worst description. That confuse, you know, this is the part of the problem is explaining what it is and why it needs to be defended to normal people.
Yeah. And that's the bigger problem, because right now, I mean, the world is on fire and everything is terrible. So there is a sense that this can kind of be snuck through just because there's so much else happening too. It's hard to, you know, talk about this when you have Nazis walking around the United States, right?
It doesn't seem like the most important
exactly.
thing.
It's a shame.
No, but even when the world isn't on fire, though, I still think you have a hard problem. Like, so the listeners of this show and people who watch this show get what net neutrality is and what the threats are. The hard thing is trying to explain that to the everyday consumer. And I can tell you, just like from a sheer like traffic perspective, when people come to Tom's Guide and we try to explain that, there's just not a lot of traffic to those types of stories because they don't really understand how it impacts them.
Yeah, I almost didn't want to start with this story because, A, it's kind of and we talk about this. It feels like we're fighting this fight all the time. And B, it is, I mean, we're preaching to the choir, and I think, although let me try to play devil's advocate a little bit. Isn't it the case the internet's been doing just fine since even before the net neutrality regulations went into effect? They're relatively recent. It's not like we didn't have a thriving, vital internet.
Mm-hmm. There are issues we fought through, right? Like Comcast throttling BitTorrent, I remember, was a big deal. And also what Netflix had to pay. I think it was Comcast as well.
Yeah, it was.
Right? They had to pay the money. So, like, we have seen these things happen, and the big companies pay out because they have to. Netflix and Google and all the others wouldn't survive if they didn't pay these ransom fees. But imagine, you know, if they didn't have to do that. Imagine the sort of innovations we've lost because these, you know, the ISPs could do whatever they want before.
Jill, is there a way that you describe this to your less technical family and friends?
I think, and it comes up often, you know, the phrase that it's a public utility. So in the same way that we don't allow free market open competition between, say, water supply companies, right, or electricity companies, there's some government regulation there. And the reason is because it's a public utility. Everybody needs it. Everybody relies on it. And you can't just allow the market to be so free that companies can gouge us. I mean, that's to me, that's like one of the simple ways to talk about it. I mean, I think you could go into some examples like saying, you know, if we take away net neutrality, your service provider could sell you a package that gives you only access to Facebook, the NewYorkTimes.com, and like a handful of other sites. So you would buy it like a package, the same way you might have bought a cable package many years ago. And that's a bad move compared to what we have now. And thinking about the internet differently than television, which is to say that it's a public utility, as I said, it's a place where people get information, it's a place where people communicate, it's a place where we do everything now. We have to think about it from that point of view.
Although the trend is right now in government to minimize government interference, the free hand of the marketplace, let it rule. In fact, the FCC also decided to eliminate rules on holding radio and newspapers in large markets. There used to be limits on how much you could own more than. Media ownership rules. You couldn't own more than four newspapers, or I can't remember what the rules were, but those are eliminated now. So what we've already seen happening in radio, which is really basically four companies own all the radio stations in the United States, we're going to see the same thing happen with newspapers, TV stations. A lot of this benefits companies like Sinclair Media, which wants to buy Tribune Media. This is the trend in Washington. This is what the people seem to want. Why can't the free market solve this? Why isn't this something that competition can solve?
Anybody? It's not really competition, right? I think that's it. It's not really competition because the big pocketed companies can basically monopolize everything and buy out the competition and kind of squash any competition, right?
Yeah, it's interesting because Google is nominally, philosophically in favor of net neutrality, but in practically, they haven't really been very outspoken, nor has Facebook, nor has Microsoft. They may pay lip service to this, but really it benefits the big incumbents. It's the next Google, the next Facebook, the next Amazon that's going to struggle.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's when you can say that it's anti-competitive in that sense, because it's preventing the next one or the next service or the next startup from really getting a leg up. But going back to your point on just how this could be priced and messaged to consumers in a potentially positive way, you could potentially have, if this all goes through, you can have ISP going to a mom and dad and saying, oh, you know what? You know, you use Facebook, you use these other services. You could probably pay less than you are right now for your internet service. And, you know, that family might not realize that they're getting less choice and less for their money.
We'll give you the Facebook, Google, Apple package, and it only costs you $10. Good luck listening to Twit. All the podcasts will go away.
Yeah, and they'll spin it as a la carte and as good for consumers.
That's part of the problem, and zero rating is another way of doing this, where companies like T-Mobile say, we won't charge you bandwidth for if you listen to Spotify or Apple Music. It feels good. It feels like I'm getting a deal. Pay less. What could be wrong with that?
it's kind of insidious too. I'm a T-Mobile customer, and there are just all these deals and discounts they're throwing at you too, like free Netflix when you subscribe, Spotify not counting against your data bandwidth and everything. It's weird because on the surface, it looks like something that's good for consumers. You have to dig a little deeper and kind of go to the nerdy level to explain to people why it's a problem. And then I don't know if general consumers will even, they would rather have their free stuff, right? Or their free Netflix and Spotify bandwidth.
When this came up a few months ago, I think it was Colbert. Was it Colbert? It was John Oliver. The FCC created a website and where you could petition, because the FCC had to open this for comments. They're legally required to open this for comments. And people were trying to. And then the FCC said, oh, no, our site is down. We've been DDoSed and took the site down for a period of time. And now there are more than a million comments in favor of eliminating net neutrality. But there's some evidence that these were generated computationally. And this is a really interesting story on Medium and the Hacker Noon column. Jeff Cao, who's a data scientist, software engineer, language nerd, big law refugee, did a syntactic analysis. It was very interesting because if you read the comments, they look like they're unique. For instance, here's a chunk of comments, five different comments, each of which contain a sentence. Americans, as opposed to Washington bureaucrats, deserve to enjoy the services they desire. But paraphrased in many ways, individual citizens, as opposed to Washington bureaucrats, should be able to select whichever services they desire. People like me, as opposed to so-called experts, should be free to buy whatever products they choose. Citizens, rather than the FCC, deserve to use whichever services we prefer. So he went through, he took these. I mean, on the face of it, those are all different. It's not like they had exactly the same contents. He figured out that one pro-repeal spam campaign used mail merge. Oh, mail merge. To disguise 1.3 million comments as unique grassroots submissions. There were likely multiple other campaigns aimed at injecting what may be several million pro-repeal comments into the system. He says, according to his analysis, it's highly likely that more than 99% of the truly unique comments were in favor of preserving net neutrality. Now, the FCC is required to listen to those comments, so it seems they may have found a way, or someone may have found a way, to make the comment system useless. He did. This is really an interesting article, which I recommend.
It sounds like a Monty Python bit. Nobody expected mail merge.
Mail merge. But if you've ever used mail merge, it's exactly how you would do it. You just have 20 different phrases, and you'd kind of mix them in. So it looked.
It kind of
like,
reminds me. It reminds me of FakeSpot. If you guys ever looked at that site,
no, what's
where,
that?
You know, that's there. So FakeSpot.com. It's where you can enter an Amazon URL. And they use algorithms to determine whether or not the user reviews are fake.
I love this.
And then it gives each product gets a grade, basically.
I bet there is a large percentage of fake, right?
Yeah.
Oh,
so
my
when we,
goodness. Oh, they have a Chrome and Firefox extension. Nice. I'm adding that as a Chrome extension. Nice. FakeSpot.
Yeah. So when we research deals, especially like through Black Friday and Cyber Monday, we often plug things into that to see what users are saying or not saying.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I don't like to talk about stuff like this without giving everybody a way to do something about it. And obviously, educating your friends and family is a good start. Finding an analogy that makes sense. I think you're right, Jill. The utility analogy is a good one. And making sure that they understand that there's some bad things that could happen. Although, again, it wasn't like we were suffering in 2014, were we? Before this was a rule? That's kind of what the chairman is saying. He's saying, you know, we're going to go back to the good old days.
Well, aren't the companies pretty slow to move in the tech space? I mean, some of the old behemoth companies, right? The ones who own the internet tubes right now. They're slow. They take a long time. I mean, sometimes I think back and, like, how long did it take Facebook to get a mobile app?
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Like, they said, we're not mobile. Mm-hmm. And they said the iPad wasn't mobile. And yeah, you're right.
And
their first app was a web page, basically.
Productive companies in the internet. So if we look at some of these other companies, like, it's going to take them a little while. They're going to be slow about it. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't protect ourselves in advance from the dangers that we can see coming. I don't know, Leo, if it's the same URL that you were talking about from either Colbert or whoever, but you can type in go FCC yourself.
That's it.
And that go FCCyourself.com and it will redirect you to the place where you can put comments.
Yes.
About this topic. And I would encourage people to do that once they've researched.
It's not too late. I mean, you could still leave comments.
Because the vote is like December 14th, I think.
Yeah. So they're still looking. Okay. Now's the time to get a million real comments.
But that website is super confusing. It took me, I don't know, 7 or 8 minutes to figure out how to leave a comment appropriately.
Yeah. I left a comment, a long comment, talking about how it would damage us, how it would harm Twit specifically.
And I would say too, like a lot of times people will encourage other friends on social media, like, hey, copy and paste this succinct analysis of the argument. But if then you go to a site like FakeSpot and you have multiple people filling in the same thing. So, well, you know, try to say something original, try to say something
Don't use mail merge. That's what. Well, it's interesting because the EFF, which I love and donate to, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, of course, has an action page, and they say here the best thing to do now is to tell the members of Congress, because Congress is, you know, of course, split over this issue, but there is the potential. You know, the FCC can only do what Congress allows it to do, and maybe the time has come for the Congress to weigh in on this and make it an actual instruction to the FCC. But they have, a sample letter. I guess you kind of have to do that, right, to get people. But maybe
to encourage people.
Yeah. It's funny because it has the phrase, a free and open internet is essential for a free society. So don't mail merge it, but maybe paraphrase it or contribute.
There's the whole thing about calling your reps.
Calling is better. They say to email, but calling is better, isn't it?
Yeah. Because they have to log all of those, and that's important.
Right.
And we were saying, like, you know, the internet wasn't on fire pre-2014, but that was the time when, Netflix and a lot of the big, you know, data companies had to pay up Comcast so they wouldn't be slowed down.
It was starting to be on fire.
Yeah.
And
it was happening. It was just quiet. Like, not everybody knew, and I don't think the companies could really publicize what they were doing either, although Netflix was really loud about it. And I think that was kind of a big deal because it affected their bottom line for sure.
There was a circulating, and I retweeted it, and I know a lot of people. I saw it all over Facebook. Let me see if I can figure out where it came from. A sheet of things that have happened in the past that these big internet service providers have done in the past that they're likely to do again, and it was a pretty damning list of things. I don't know if I can find it in my tweet stream. But retweeting or posting on resharing on Facebook, things like that, I think is also useful, right? Because it gives people concrete examples of things that will now be legal. And I think people look at that and they go, well, I also retweeted Minion Clyburn, who is one of the Democrat commissioners on the FCC, who has a fact sheet explaining what the proposal is. She's, of course, a minority, unfortunately, on the board at the FCC, but she will be voting against this. But she's going to be outvoted December 14th unless something happens. But she has published a 2-page fact sheet on what net neutrality is, what the Chairman Pai's initiative would do, and so forth. So that will also be a useful tool for you. I think you're right, Jill. Use your social network to try to spread this around.
And one thing for people who are afraid of talking on the phone, call your reps after hours.
You can just leave a message.
There you go.
There are apps for that, aren't they? That like have the phone numbers in there, and you just make the call on your smartphone. It'll do it all the dialing for you, and do it every day. I know people say that. It's something easy you can do that might make a difference. I don't know. At this point, I really feel like the current commission doesn't care.
Yeah.
That they're going to do the bidding of the donors.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't always come down to money too, right? Like the only people who are in favor of this really are the people who are lobbying.
Right.
Right. Like it's just the companies. I have yet to hear an actual non-libertarian human being say that this is a good idea. It's just the companies that want it. Nobody else wants it. Isn't but they're the ones who have the money.
They have the money. They have the lobbyists. Yeah.
Yeah, they contribute to all the campaign funds, and there you go.
Just remember, though, that the campaign funds are only useful in swaying votes, and we're the voters. We have ultimate control of the votes. So if we, as the people, say we don't want this, ultimately, if enough of us stand up and say no, that's more important than any money put into the campaign coffers of these representatives.
That's an ideal way to look at it, but
I know
it's
I'm
not
an idealist.
It's not like we vote for people and then they fulfill their campaign promises.
Oh gosh, right? Yeah. That's a good point.
It doesn't work that
I still think it would be good for them to at least have an inkling that this could sway our vote one way or another. Obviously, it's not just about this, but I think it all comes back to the messaging too and what you tell the everyday consumer. I think it boils down to two things. You know, one, you will likely have less choice in terms of the services that you're able to use. And two, you will likely wind up paying more than you are now for internet service. And we already pay too much.
And there is an economic argument to make with people who, traditional conservatives and Republicans who say, you know, we have to have a vital economy. Government regulation can get in the way of this. It's not government regulation of the internet. It's government regulation of internet service providers who want to make a less innovative, less competitive economy. That the internet has been a real real engine to building a great economy in this country because of the innovation that could happen. And this is ultimately a way to block innovation, to block new companies, to block new ideas. It supports the existing businesses, but it harms any new businesses coming along. And so if you believe in a true free market economy and you believe in the power of American innovation and building a strong economy, then you will be against rules that repeal net neutrality. Net neutrality is good for the economy. It's good for business, and ultimately. It's just bad for these handful of small businesses.
I really hope that bigger names in tech just kind of step up and go to the government and start talking loudly about this too. Like everybody who was in that room with Donald Trump and was looking very uncomfortable, you know, this is the time to weigh in.
Yeah.
A little bit of what maybe
now's
they
the
owe
time.
You for being there.
Yeah. All right. I think we've done our duty, and it felt like duty. and I know that some of you have fast forwarded, so please don't stop. It's okay. We're done. But we have lots of other things to talk about, and I'm really thrilled to have the panel with us. Jill Duffy is here from PC Magazine before she heads off to Bucharest. It's great to have you, Jill.
Thank
contributing
you.
Editor, PC Magazine. Devendra Hardawar from Engadget. Senior editor there, and Mark Spoonhour, who's editor-in-chief EIC of Tom's Guide. I grew up, well, not grew up, but I've been a reader of Tom's Guide since Tom was there. I'm a big fan, and I'm glad to see it's in good hands.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, we took over, I think it was in 2013.
Really? I thought it was longer than that. What happened to Tom? Where'd he go?
I'm not sure of his whereabouts.
You keeping track of Tom? He's like the MySpace guy. He's like, he's off enjoying the world, enjoying life. But Tom's Guide is still a really great source. In fact, a lot of good coverage of Cyber Monday and Black Friday deals. Let's talk about internet shopping. It was a very big couple of days for e-commerce this week, and a bigger day still coming tomorrow. Our show today brought to you by Blue Apron. We love Blue Apron. I get my Blue Apron box once a week with three delicious meals, all the ingredients to make an amazing meal. I chose from the website, blueapron.com. They've got the menus. You can pick the meals you want. They have vegetarian meals for any dietary requirement. And then you get exactly the right pre-portioned ingredients. The produce is beautiful. It's perfect. The meat and fish are fresh. They all come from local farms, no GMO ingredients, meat with no added hormones. And wow, what great stuff. You can cook it yourself. It's like a cooking class in a box. And there's something about making the food that really brings it alive. You smell the aromas. The kids come in and say, oh, what's for dinner? That smells fantastic. For date night, you want to impress somebody? Make them a Blue Apron meal. The mission for Blue Apron to make home cooking accessible to everyone while supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. That's you. The number one fresh ingredient recipe delivery service in the country. Listen to some of the meals on the menu this week. Seared steaks and garlic butter and with oven fries and romaine salad. I've made that one. I love that one. Ooh, what's that? The Thai yellow curry. That looks fantastic. With bok choy and jasmine rice. Now, I have to admit, I wasn't a bok choy guy until we got Blue Apron. I've learned more ways and more unique kinds of bok choy. There's lots of different kinds to make bok choy. I am now a bok choy fanatic. And look what you get in the box. Exactly the ingredients you need. No more, no less to make the meal. Butternut squash pasta with kale and brown butter walnuts. Barramundi, which is a fish I had never heard of, and I cooked it for the first time, and now I'm a fan. And mixed mushrooms with jasmine rice and Napa cabbage. Roasted chicken and fall vegetables with cranberry and ginger compote. One of the things I found is once I've made the meal, I make it again and again because now I know how to do it. It's like a roadmap. I know the way. Cooking together is great. They have family plans, too, with kid-friendly ingredients. Take the recipes you love. Add your family twist. Look at that cheeseburger, the pimento cheeseburgers. Oven fries, baked potatoes. See, we used to, there's a good example. We used to buy the frozen pre-cut fries at the grocery store. Never again. Once I learned how to make amazing oven fries from Blue Apron, it's so much easier and it's a lot less expensive. Blue Apron, less than $10 a meal. That's a better deal than you'll get in any grocery store. And we're giving you an even better deal. We're treating you to your first dinner, a $30 value. $30 off your first delivery, plus free shipping. BlueApron.com/twit. BlueApron.com/twit. You don't have to do it every night. But I tell you what, it's so much better than going out after, you know, hard day's work. Go home. You got everything you need. Your meal's ready in half an hour. Kids, they smell it. Oh, it's fantastic. BlueApron.com/twit. Try Blue Apron for the holiday season. And it'd be a great gift, too, by the way. Really nice gift for people in your life. BlueApron.com/twit. So I'm calling Thanksgiving now Black Friday Eve. Forget the turkey. It's Black Friday Eve. And it turns out shopping on Black Friday Eve, a.k.a. Thanksgiving, was through the roof. What was the growth? 18% year over year. And a lot of it on mobile. Turns out people were getting on their phones on Thanksgiving, maybe after the meal, I don't know, and buying stuff. Is that wild? And then, of course,
probably at the dinner table.
This Thanksgiving, I know a lot of people didn't want to see their family. They were afraid of the conversations. And so I think a lot of people, I think they maybe either avoided the traditional family meal or during the meal, they went online and bought stuff.
It's just so easy now.
It is. It's easy. And you can do it on your phone. Almost $3 billion in sales on Thanksgiving Day.
Amazon has this down to science, too, with like the lightning deals. Like you gotta keep an eye on it. Otherwise, you miss out on saving $10 from a Blu-ray or something.
Yeah.
There's that. And then the other companies are trying to step up, too, right? So Best Buy has their own deals, and they're trying to get better on mobile, too. So, yeah, it's a fully optimized capitalist machine. It's kind of crazy.
It's also changed, just like the impact of Amazon in particular, it's also changed the way we work. We, for the first time ever, we actually staffed a team of about a half dozen people, and that's all they've been doing.
I see that.
Deals,
oh, man.
To vet them.
Yeah.
So they are working through the weekend, and I owe them a bottle of wine or something.
Yeah. TomsHardware.com, you can see a bunch of stuff on Black Friday deals. Now, and there are other sites, too. I know Wirecutter, it's like all hands on deck for Wirecutter. I know
Wirecutter is great because they definitely sift out the bad deals, and there are so many bad deals and things that aren't really as cheap as you think they would be.
Yes. In fact, I think that's what Tom's doing, too, is the idea is you can get sucked into something and buying something you might regret just because you go, oh, that's a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
Our friend Renee Ritchie from iMore also has – iMore has a new site called Thrillist. This is Mobile Nations. What is it?
Yeah, Thrillist is something else.
Thrillist is places to eat. No, yeah, Thrift – what is it? Thrifter?
Thrifter.
Thank you. I hear in the background somebody shouting, Thrifter! Same idea, though, right? To figure out what deals are good. Black Friday, also bigger than ever. And what's interesting, it's become an international thing, even though they don't celebrate Thanksgiving anywhere else in any other countries in the world. Black Friday is celebrated. Commerce is always an international idea.
Yeah, I heard a great report about that recently. So what's happening is people in other countries are realizing that they can get these amazing deals on American products. And there are these intermediary companies who handle the purchasing and the shipping to a central location. So let's say I have a warehouse in, you know, Maryland or something, and I get all my Chinese consumers to put in their orders. I make the purchase, the merchandise comes to me, and then I bulk ship it to them, which lowers their shipping costs. So they're still getting a pretty good deal. And the report I heard was just talking about how this has become like an increasingly huge chunk of the sales that are happening on Black Friday.
How interesting. They're using mail drops, basically.
Yeah, so they're not even, it's not even like, oh, there are sales in other countries, which is like, it's kind of picking up a little bit in some places. But it's like they're taking advantage of our sales now in the U.S. on U.S. products.
Wow. It's funny because the Times has a story about how Amazon, it's going the other way too. Amazon is recruiting Indian merchants for bedding, jewelry, kitchenware, and clothing, shipping stuff to Amazon's warehouses for shipping to the U.S. 270,000 Indian sellers have signed up since Amazon began the outreach 2 years ago, making products for the American market that Amazon can sell at a lower cost through their fulfillment services. So, you know, in a way, this is really about globalization. I don't know if that's a bad thing at all, right?
But also, yeah, really about Amazon, too. How many times have we said Amazon?
It's really Amazon. Black Friday is really the Amazon holiday, isn't it?
The Amazon, that's what it is. It's Amazon's, like, time to shine, and they're really doing it. I don't know. I had to get up at 5 a.m.
No.
On Black Friday to, like, look out for news and stuff. I
pulled for
the
work.
Straw. For
Oh, I'm sorry.
But they're, like, in terms of deals, there are a lot of, like, nice little things, but Amazon, it's the time when Amazon can shave off a lot of money from its own products. So all of a sudden, it looks like they're the place to be, right? You can get an Echo cheaper, an Echo Plus or something. The best deals I saw were probably those LG OLEDs, which are amazing TVs. And yeah, those prices are insane at this point.
Yeah, that's what my favorite TV is, my LG. Mm-hmm. Let's see, it was B6. I bought it last year. It's B7 this year.
It's insane how cheap they are.
Great 4K TV that goes perfectly with your Xbox One X. And we become such a. Jeez Louise. I'm sorry, Mark. Go ahead.
I just think we have different definitions of cheap. Because it's on sale for $1,500, which is certainly a lot less than what it was before, but that's still about triple the price of what the average consumer is willing to pay for a big screen TV.
Well, and people do buy really cheap TVs. You have a TCL 49-inch 4K for $349 listed on your site.
The TCL P series, their 55-inch, was down to like $400, $450, which is one of the best TVs we've ever seen.
They're not bad TVs. They have Roku built in, which I really like.
Yeah.
I got one of these for my mom because it was so cheap. Although I see here it says ships in 2 to 3 months. That's not out of stock. You can get a 43-inch, but don't. You'd be sorry. It's too small.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Here's one that's in stock November 28th, the 65-inch. 65-inch TV, see price in cart. They don't want to.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to add it to my cart. Let's see. $927.
Not bad.
So, yeah, I mean, I think the LG is probably a better TV, but most people probably would say, I don't care.
Yeah. The LG is, like, OLED stuff, that's why I tell geeks, right? The people who've been holding out, like, especially people who bought plasma TVs because they knew LCDs were kind of inferior for a long time. OLED is your upgrade. That's the techie upgrade rather than spending money on a newer LCD or something.
You also see... Go ahead, Mark.
I'm just going to say, like, if you are in the market for a premium TV, that $1,500 price point is definitely better than what you'll get for a QLED set from Samsung, which is sort of like fake OLED.
It drives me crazy. I say it every time I can. Q does not equal O. It's a quantum dot LCD television, not an OLED TV. But the Q is just a little, it's one little stroke difference. It's so close. And you got to think Samsung is thinking, maybe they'll.
Oh, they know. Yeah, they know. Like,
That's shameful. One thing you do see is it's like when you take a magnet to a bunch of filings. You start to see the alliances, who thinks of whom as competition. For instance, Google, knowing that Amazon was going to drop the price of the dot, made sure that its Google Home Mini was $10 less. You know, you could see where the competitors are. Sharp, LG, Samsung, all kind of trying to get their chunk of that market. And of course, TCL is a Chinese company. It's kind of interesting to see that Chinese companies like Huawei, Xiaomi, TCL do the same thing to the Korean companies that the Korean companies did to the Japanese companies a decade ago.
Uh-huh. The OEMs are becoming the big brands, basically.
So, so you know, 10, 20 years ago, it was Sony, Panasonic, Toshiba. It was the Japanese companies. Lucky Gold Star, the grocery store, the drugstore TV in the back. the CEO of Lucky Gold Star said, "Why, you know, we should." And so LG and Samsung made a very active play to take that market away. Now the Japanese TV companies are struggling. The Korean companies are on top, but watch out because here comes TCL and Huawei and Xiaomi and the Chinese companies. And since they're all made in China, they probably have an advantage. They have
a the third largest TV manufacturer in the world at this point.
TCL is
pretty crazy. TCL, yeah. Since 2013, that was the stat I've seen.
With very little brand recognition, right?
Although when I go to something like CES, like every year I see their booth like grow and grow and grow. Which is
they took over the Microsoft booth, didn't they?
Yep.
When Microsoft,
and yet they don't have to do a lot of marketing in order for people to find their stuff
because it's such a price sensitive thing. So here comes the biggest day of the three, Cyber Monday, which I don't really get. I mean, originally Cyber Monday was coined because the theory was, but this seems like old times. The internet at home is so slow. I'm going to go to work to buy stuff on Monday.
Was that it?
I think that was.
I thought it was that it was all the deals were happening in stores and brick and mortar stores Friday, right? And then the weekend is like the weekend people are kind of shopping, traveling, whatever. And then Monday was the day that the online sales started. I think that's what it was.
Okay.
Yeah, my understanding it was a marketing term that was coined, I think, around 2005, just to get people more comfortable with the concept of shopping online during the holidays, and obviously it worked.
Yeah.
So what are you seeing, Mark, in Cyber Monday deals? Will they compete with Black Friday and Black Friday evening deals?
Yeah, I think they will. And some of them will be a continuation of what we've already seen, like the Amazon Echo Dot being $29. There's a great console deals like the Xbox One S for $189 and the PS4 Pro is also on sale. One of the surprise categories for us this year in terms of just the amount of interest and also the amount of deals is soundbars, because whenever we do a TV review, unless it's from like a really high-end brand, like we almost always say, get a soundbar with this, because as TVs get thinner and thinner, the sound is not as good. So we're seeing a lot of great deals for soundbars, some as low as $48. There's one from Vizio that we really like.
So according to Wikipedia, the term Cyber Monday was coined by Ellen Davis, who was a PR person at shop.org. They noted that the Monday after Thanksgiving was the 12th biggest shopping day historically. So they put out a press release saying it's one of the biggest shopping days of the year, online shopping days of the year. In November 2005, the New York Times said, quote, "The name Cyber Monday, I think they confirm my thought, grew out of the observation that millions of otherwise productive working Americans, fresh off a Thanksgiving weekend of window shopping, were returning to high-speed internet connections at work on Monday and buying what they liked." At the time, according to Wikipedia, a lot of people had slow internet at home. But you're right, it was a marketing term. And by the way, they've tried other ones. Tony Velado at 1-800-Flowers coined White Wednesday the day before Thanksgiving. It did not catch on. White Wednesday, Black
Just
Friday.
Just when you need flowers.
Yeah. Get some flowers on White Wednesday. I don't think that would play these days. I think
that's something else.
It's a different kind of day. All right. So should I shop on Monday? I mean, is that going to be
shop whenever? Like, it's this is all meaningless at this point.
I think it is.
The deals are everywhere.
Black Friday.
I would love to see a chart. I love charts, right? I want to see a chart that shows, 10 products. The price before the week before Thanksgiving, the price the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, the price on what is the Friday one called?
Whatever Black
the
Friday. Friday. There's
Black Friday. Friday.
There's Thanksgiving. There's White Wednesday.
Then I want to see it again, like the day before Christmas, and then I want to see it again in January when everybody's like earning stuff and everything goes on sale again.
Because
I want to see a chart of what those prices are. How big are the prices?
Actually, you can.
You have that chart.
Well, one of the Yeah, well, no. Well, one of the best sites out there for tracking products, at least on Amazon, is Camel Camel Camel.
Right.
So you go there, you enter the product, and then it shows you the price history of that to see if that sale or whatever that discount is in the slash or that number is legit or not.
You can see the top price drops. Here you go. Your charts, they're all here.
Yes.
Who would buy this? The Cybertron PC Palladium VR-ready gaming PC. It looks like, what the hell is this?
It's fine. It's a gaming PC.
Oh, okay. I thought that was a screen. Like, I thought that thing on the side was a screen. I thought that's ugly.
It's probably a multicolor LCD. That's probably why it looks like that. The lighting, yeah.
Okay. Currently unavailable, so I, you know, but but if you could get it.
So close.
Yeah.
So close. So I almost bought a Cybertron PC. This close. So, but you do see the graph, which is cool, and you see the dips.
Yeah. That's a good tool.
Yeah, that's really Camel, Camel, Camel.
That's awesome.
Why is it
and
named
the price changes?
Camel, Camel,
yeah,
Camel.
They need some marketing help for sure. The price changes can be pretty severe. Like, I was just really closely watching those LG OLED prices over the past year, and like after Black Friday, they went back up by like another $500. So you have a really small pocket of time to get some of these bigger deals.
Isn't I always thought January was the best time to buy a TV. So here's yeah, this confirms what you've been saying. This is the graph for the LG B7, which is their kind of their lower cost, but it's the high quality panel. And it started at $2,300 in July, dropped, probably that was like Amazon Prime Day or something in the middle of August, then dropped again early October, and is now at absolutely its lowest price.
Insane. Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
And last year's TVs started at like $4,000. They're 55-inch. And by Black Friday, it was down to $1,800. So
yeah, of course I bought it when it was back at $4,000.
Sorry, Leo. Curse of the early adopter. Yeah.
Black Friday sales, $5.03 billion in online sales. But I think the thing is most interesting. This is from Adobe. I always think of them as the Photoshop guys, but apparently they also track online sales. $2 billion of that on mobile only, on people buying stuff on their phones, on their phones.
It's so much harder to buy on a computer, honestly, at this point. Like, why? What's the benefit unless you're researching and comparing different things?
Do people have like the Amazon app? Is that how they do it?
Yeah, so easy. Yeah. In 2009. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just saying they had still the one-click shopping too, so it's so easy.
It's way too easy.
It's all Amazon's fault. But yeah, I bought a TV from Amazon in 2009 from my phone, and you know the app was good by that point. So they've been doing that for a while.
The other conflict point: the game consoles, both Sony and Microsoft, at war trying to get. Because I think Microsoft learned a lesson with the release of the Xbox One, which was $100 more than the Sony PlayStation 4.
Mm-hmm. And gotta get that Kinect in there.
That $100. Was enough to power the PlayStation way beyond the Xbox in terms of sales. So now they got an Xbox One S for $189, but that's not the 4K. Well, I guess it's 4K for
sort of
TV,
4K.
Yeah. But not for. And then
it has 4K Blu-ray and it upscales some.
Yeah,
games a little bit.
I used it. I actually liked it, but immediately got a 1X the minute I could. Because
but they made the same mistake again. The One X is $500, and the PS4 Pro is $400.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
Microsoft
bucks.
Don't learn.
And there's no Kinect. I'm disappointed. I thought the Kinect at the time was the fastest selling consumer electronics product of all time.
I think that was a good marketing bite that they like. Even if that stat was true, that was a good marketing bite. That wasn't enough to make you bundle it with your next big console because there wasn't enough developer support or consumer interest to need that.
If there were a chart of not price but sales, the Kinect went like this, straight up, and then straight down.
Yeah. And it was sort of like the next Wii for a while.
Yeah.
In terms, because and my kids actually still use it on the Xbox 360, and they love it for like the sports games and that sort of thing. But
it measured your heart rate. You could do the exercise, and it would say, "Work harder, work harder." Maybe that's why I did.
The dancing games were really fun. Like there were a lot of things. It's just the developers. Yeah. It wasn't as good as it could have been, and definitely not something that everybody needed. You know, it was a big misstep. And the One X, it's a great machine, but. That the PS4 Pro was out last year. It was $100 less last year, and now I've seen prices as low as $350. So if you have, you know, a new 4K TV and you want to do some 4K gaming, the PS4 Pro still makes the most sense for most people.
Yeah. My understanding is that the Xbox One X is slightly, or it is more powerful in terms
yes,
of just the
sheer
hardware, but they just don't have the exclusives that Sony does, and that hasn't changed in the last couple of years, and that's why people buy the consoles for the games.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so who's shopping on Monday? Nobody. See,
I'm always shopping.
I'm never shopping.
Really? You don't? Do you not use your smart?
I made Black Friday a buy nothing day. Yeah. You know, just I'll give you a little background about me. So I came into tech writing because I was a writer first, and it was the year, you know, 2000, 2001, and I finished college, and if I wanted a job, that's what I had to do. So I always like to tell people that just because I come about a lot of tech topics from a non technologically perspective.
That's why we love you, Jill, because you're a normal.
I'm and a skeptic, I think.
Well, appropriately. Yeah. See, Devendra and I don't know about you yet, Mark, but I guess you're probably in this group too. We're starry-eyed gadget
lovers.
Yeah,
you guys eat it up and you're like willing to spend the money and you want
I got the Apple Watch. I got the iPhone 10. I got the Pixel 2 XL. I got it all.
And I'm definitely like the late adopter. You know, I'll get the products to try them out and to test them. But for the things that I buy for myself, I want the thing that's going to last. I don't want a new TV every 2 years. I want it to last a really long time. And I don't want to pay top dollar. Like, I'm willing to wait a couple of months or a year or two to get the appropriate price for the product.
Okay, Jill, tell us, what is your favorite tech thing these days? It's the thing you love. Is there anything, or is it like your bicycle?
I love my bicycle.
I know you do, but I mean,
I really love my bicycle.
Anything with a chip in it, anything at all? Do you have an electric bike, maybe?
No. Oh, not. I hate electric bikes. I really hate them. I don't see what the point. You know, I understand some places, right? You got steep hills or something, but it just ruins the whole idea of being on a very simple machine.
I know.
That's powered by your body.
I know.
I love my phone. I did get a Microsoft Surface laptop.
Yeah.
I don't love it. I don't love it. I really wanted to.
I'm trying to make you one of us, Jill. Come on.
And we need more tech people who think like Jill.
For no, sure. I agree.
I try to be like a realistic shopper.
I agree.
Too. Like,
yeah.
Well, the 4K stuff for so long has been so overhyped and so like, just like it hasn't been great, especially when it comes to gaming. We've reached a weird point where 4K is a big marketing term, even though it doesn't mean much of a visual difference for
okay.
most people.
Yeah, I'm an idiot because not only did I buy the 1X, but I immediately bought Assassin's Creed Origins, Madden Football 18, Forza 7, and Call of Duty World War II. Four 4K games. I'm not, by the way, which I'll play a total of 1 hour for all four of them. But you know, I'm in Assassin's Creed Origin and I'm wandering around. I'm in Egypt. I'm in, you know,
it's amazing.
You feel like it's beautiful it's still a game. You wouldn't confuse it with the real world. But for a game, it's very vivid. HDR makes it, you know, you feel the sun. I liked it, but
it's the HDR. It's not the 4K.
It's the HDR.
Game definitely
it
isn't being rendered in 4K, which is the other thing we're kind of dealing with, right? It may be rendered at 1080p or slightly higher, but the horsepower you need to really render a game like that in full 4K, it's super expensive. PC gamers have that privilege. I don't think it's definitely not worth it for most people. So that's the sort of like tech advancement I'm trying to like just be more realistic about. Yeah.
See, Jill knows something that I and maybe you have never learned, which is you buy that thing, you think it's going to be great, you think it's going to be life-changing, and it's not.
Leo, I can't believe you're still wearing an Apple Watch.
Oh.
I don't know anybody who still has one on their wrist. Like,
really?
I gave up on mine.
Yeah, I think a lot of people found it was really disappointing in the end. And how are you going to wear a watch that needs to be charged every single day?
Well, I have a routine when I go to bed. I have a bunch of chargers and I empty my pockets and plug everything in as I'm going to bed. And making sure that everything will be fully powered in the morning. You just get used to that.
And doesn't Apple have a new charging station coming out that's going to charge all three at once or something like that, your phone, watch, et cetera?
I have a very, very good excuse, Jill. This is my job. I'm supposed to.
Tax write-offs.
And there, I mean, I do. So one thing I do that is really crazy is I don't, none of these are product review loaners. I don't do loaners. I buy everything, which really does add up.
That's hard.
And, and you can have the tax write-off. You're still paying a lot of that money. You're not, it's not, nothing's free here.
Yeah.
But I feel like if I'm going to review an Apple Watch, I need to wear it every day for a few months so that I can talk about it. So I can, you know, say what it's like, not if after the first week, but for a while and similar. But
well, it's been, what, 3 years now? He could take it off.
No, this is the new one. This is the new one.
You're paying extra for the LTE built in, right?
Yeah. I don't know. I have a problem.
Do you use it to make calls?
I have. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like the Batman phone. And I don't even have to have my it's a $1,200 iPhone X with it. I can But Jill, you know the lesson I have yet to learn. The lesson at my advanced age, you would have thought I have learned time and time again, was it doesn't make you any happier in the long run. You just have to buy something else that maybe that'll make you happy. Like this.
Buy yourself an expensive meditation app.
I know, really. like the Atari, I just bought this. This is the Atari Flashback. This is the video game system many people grew up with.
Oh, man. No.
It's only $79, Devendra. Actually, $40. Yeah, $40. Look at that. You could play Pitfall. Show the kids what real gaming is like.
You play that for 5 minutes and never touch it again.
I have a Commodore 64. Same thing. It's all in a joystick and gathering dust in my office. You know, you'd think I'd learn a lesson. But I feel I'm doing good. I'm helping the American economy. That's what I'm doing.
Do you have a favorite gadget of the moment, Leo?
I do. I'm a fan of, and I think you would be a fan of, the Echo Show, the Amazon Echo that has a screen on it. No comment. Huh?
Silence.
No, I had an Echo for about 6 or 8 weeks, and I couldn't stand it.
Oh.
I was really disappointed with it, to be honest. I think it's great for people who are willing to tinker and are willing to experiment within the limitations of what it cannot do. But for somebody who just wanted it to work, wanted it to be mobile, wanted it to respond well, it was really disappointing.
Give you an example from this weekend.
Okay.
For the Echo.
Yeah.
So I set up for the first time the multi-room music.
Yeah.
And I had Christmas carols going because we were doing the decorating thing.
Yeah.
And then anytime there was a commercial on Pandora, the music stopped in one room.
Oh, God.
And
it slowly whittled away at your group until there was nothing left, basically.
Yeah. So you almost had like to reboot it after the fact. So I get what Jill is saying in terms of the maybe not living up to the hype sometimes. But I do think that the show, you know, it's funny. Like when people look at it, they don't like the design.
Yeah, they think it's ugly.
Too boxy.
Yeah, I love it.
And when you start using it, like it's funny is like when I'm like making lunch for the kids or whatever else, like these snippets that come up on the screen and the headlines that come through.
Yeah,
it makes you wonder whether or not they're tailing it towards your shopping interests and things like that. But overall, I think it's better now that they finally put YouTube back.
Yes, although it's a terrible YouTube interface. Thank you, Google. It used to be a full screen interface, but now it has the kind of the YouTube bars on it and stuff. Although somebody in our chat room, I think Scooter X, said that you can say Echo Zoom in or Zoom out, Echo Zoom, and it will go back to the old full screen. So that's good. Yeah, so I have in my flash briefing. So, you know, you can say Echo, you know, tell me about my day or give me my news. And the flash briefing, I have the Tonight Show monologue. And because it's got video, I see, you know, Jimmy there and he, what's his name? Jerry Fallon, the guy, Fallon guy.
They're all Jimmys.
They're Jimmy. Yeah. I don't know who it is. Anyway,
Jimmy Fallon and Kimmel.
They're both Jimmys. I have the Jimmys on my screen, and I like to see the Jimmys, even though I have no idea which Jimmy I'm watching.
It is interesting how much they were diversifying the whole Echo family. So I'm not too hot on the screen, but I like the added functionality we're seeing. Like Echoes are great when you have the smart home stuff. I have the Philips Hue lights, and that is the ideal way to control that whole setup. You don't want to do it through an app. You just
see,
want
now
to
that I think you're nuts, because I don't want to have colored lights turning
so
on
great.
And off. And
it's so great.
I had the Hues, and I had it set. I had an if this, then that recipe that would make them dim the lights at sun or come on at sunset, and then I'd have them ramp up in the morning and all that stuff. And when we moved, I didn't bother. I just left them behind, you know.
Well, have you guys used the Echo Routines, which is their new, like, kind of bundled skill things? That's kind of cool.
Oh, you can have, like, Echo go to bed, and then it will have a bunch of different things. Yeah, that's cool.
It'll do specific things. So in the morning, I say, like, you know, Echo, good morning, and it'll turn on my living room lights and give me the weather and can read news and stuff. It's not super smart yet. Like, I want to be able to add other functionality, but it's kind of cool.
And see, I'm like Jill when it comes to home automation. That's a bridge too far. I don't.
Oh, really?
It's so much work to get the home to do. And by the way, I mean, my toaster oven is on the internet. My sous vide machine's on the internet. I have a meat thermometer that's on the internet. I'm not kidding. It's called the meter. So it's all on the internet, but I haven't yet created a smart home. I don't. I just feels like a lot.
You have like little pockets of smart things.
I'm smart in pockets. Yeah.
And I think that's why Amazon is starting to bundle a lot more when it comes to the Echo and the Echo Dot. They're not just giving you the smart speaker. It's like, here's what it works with.
Yeah. One of the deals with the Dot is a switch. You get a switch and the Dot. Yeah. Smart switch. Mm-hmm. I understand though, Jill, you move a lot and you don't want.
Yeah. I was doing an unbylined work for a company that does custom home automation installations, and they wanted me to kind of like pull some research and look at what is the difference between doing a Google Home or an Amazon Echo setup and getting a custom home installation.
People ask me that all the time.
Oh my God, it's like night and day. So I understand that for people who move a lot, people who rent, people who can't afford to spend couple thousand dollars up front. Yeah. They want the toys. They want to play with it. They want to screw in the light bulb and connect it to their phone, yada, yada, yada. But the custom home stuff it's just so much more thoughtful and has a lot more design put into it.
Right.
So the wires go into your walls. They're not strewn across your tables. And the system becomes centralized. And you think about that before you start buying all the products and piecing them together. So before you even start, you say, what do I want this to do? What do I want my life to be when I walk into and out of rooms? Whereas the experience you get with these, you know, $100 products is very piecemeal. Everything needs to be upgraded after 2 or 3 years. Nothing initially connects very well and works together very well. It's sort of slowly coming together with centralized platforms. So again, like, I think it's fun for people who want to tinker and fun for people who, you know, they rent or whatever, but just compared to what is actually possible, you know, like the dream is definitely in the custom.
But the boy, isn't that expensive? I mean, you're talking thousands and thousands of dollars.
I think the smallest setups are like automated blinds, air conditioning, heating. And you can do that for like, I think it's around $1,000.
Oh, that's
not bad. It all depends on the size of your home and what stage are you in with your home and all that kind of stuff.
But you bring in somebody to do that, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, is they're an expert and they've done it a million times and they know what people want. And they know how it works. And I actually tried to look into, can you get some curtains to set up to connect to a Google Home? And it's like, you can sort of do it, but you need an engineering degree to figure out how to install them properly.
It's by the way, it's a fantasy that I think comes straight out of, you know, like 60s movies like In Like Flint, that you would flip a switch and your rotating bed would come out, the curtains would go down, the lighting would go down, and a jazzy song would come on the turntable. It's some strange male fantasy thing that nobody
Tony
really.
Stark, Bill Gates.
Yeah. It's not really, but actually, isn't a lot of technology come from 12-year-old boys' fantasies of what it means to have the good life?
Or impress other people.
Or impress their lady friends. Yeah. That wouldn't impress you, though. In fact, it would make you run if the bed came.
I want to see it. I want to see a chart of the energy savings.
Oh, God. Let's take a break. And we'll talk about more things you can buy, more junk you can, more crap you can add to your life, because that's what we do. Dvinder Hardwar, this is his life at Engadget. He's senior editor there.
That's so many boxes, all these boxes.
Look at all those. You got Amazon boxes all around you. It's just, And then look at Jill Duffy, where it's a beautiful aesthetic.
Minimalism.
There's no boxes.
That's what I dream of.
Boxes. You're like Jack Kerouac, who said, if you have a rug, that's too much. You got to be able to, got to be ready to hit the road at any moment. And also a brand new, well, we're thrilled to have him, Mark Spoonhour from editor-in-chief of The Great Tom's Guide and Laptop Magazine. I'm guessing that the people who own Tom's Guide own Laptop Magazine.
Yes.
That's a lot to be EIC of both of those.
It is. Yeah, but wow. It is a lot of fun.
Who's the parent company?
So Perch is the parent company.
Perch, okay.
And,
Perch.
Yeah, so they also own sites like space.com and Life Science and Top 10 Reviews.
Yeah, Perch is great. It's funny, I for 10 years worked for Ziff Davis, but Ziff Davis isn't Ziff Davis anymore. They've like spun out into many, many different things.
Yeah.
And I was reading that Ziff Davis had just bought Mashable, right? Mashable, which was a high flyer a few years ago worth $250 million, a quarter of a billion. Sold for a bargain basement, I'd take it, $50 million to Ziff Davis. And I mentioned this to Mary Jo Foley, who writes for ZDNet. She said, no, that's not, it's a different Ziff Davis. It's not ZDNet. ZDNet is owned by CBS Interactive. The Ziff Davis that bought Mashable is owned by J2
Global.
The EFX company.
Yeah. They own PC Mag.
What?
Yeah, Ziff Davis owns PC Mag, and then a few years ago, J2 Global bought Ziff Davis.
Ziff Davis. But Ziff Davis is not ZDNet.
I guess not.
So PC Mag, okay, wow. So PC Magazine's owned by J2 as well.
Yeah.
Now, the only reason I knew J2 is because I used eFax for years. They did other things, obviously, than fax software.
Yeah.
I hope. Yeah. Or they're getting it. They're smart. They're saying it's the end of the line for faxes. Let's get into something that's really on a growth, technology journalism.
Yeah, but they own a lot of other companies.
Do they? Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's an umbrella over a whole.
So it's
network.
Like SoftBank or something. It's just a big holding company.
I think
like
so. That.
PC Mag, man, I love PC Mag. See, these were all same company when I worked for Ziff Davis. And I love PC Magazine, and Bill McCrone, the editor-in-chief, who's passed away since, was a great friend. You don't publish a print edition anymore. It's all online now.
No, that folded in 2011, I think.
Yeah. Wow. The world has changed in many ways. Jill, what do you write about for PC Magazine? What's your beat?
Software. I love software because it can come with me when I move from location to location.
There's nothing to carry.
So I do a lot right now with project management software, nerdy as that sounds. It's something that people really have a need to understand.
You know what's nerdy?
What?
Stacey Higginbotham, who is one of our hosts on This Week in Google on Wednesday, confessed she uses a Gantt chart system to plan her Thanksgiving meal. That's a story for you, Jill.
That's overboard. Yeah.
She's here's the critical path. But you know what? It kind of made sense. And when I did a search for it, you see a lot of there's actually a lot of people using Excel and other programs to make organizational charts for their workflow.
The way I see it, I mean, project management software is kind of what came before all of these other collaboration tools and communication tools. And for me, they are just a wonderful way to get away from email, which has been an ongoing problem for the last two decades since email really came into existence. So it's really encouraging for me to see people adopt these new tools, figure out ways to use them, and that there's such a wealth of tools. So if you are a small company with 5 or 6 employees, there's something for you that doesn't cost a lot. And if you are a giant mega corporation with satellite offices all over the world and thousands of projects going on, there's something for you too. So I really enjoy the breadth
It's not just Microsoft Project. Everybody's using Project.
No. Basecamp. Basecamp is like super old school at this point.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. We had David Hennemeyer Hansen, the author of Basecamp, and Jason Fried we've had on, both of them on Triangulation. I won't say anything to him about it being old school.
They know their market. They found their niche, but they don't do Gantt charts. They're better with visuals, right? Like that's another good example. Like companies that use a lot of visuals and have to show one another like comps and mark them up. I don't like this. I do like this. You need different software than something that's super heavy detailed about scheduling and rearranging schedules if somebody misses a deadline and stuff
like that. Come to think of it, you know, because of Slack, this has become a very hot category, hasn't it? This whole idea of collaborating and Agile has made a big difference in that regard. And
that's Jira and all
Jira,
those.
Yeah. It's a very interesting field.
Yeah.
Well, we have much more to talk about. And actually, you said something I thought very interesting. You're interested in software. I'm going to talk about a Johnny Ive interview in which he said, that's the key, in just a second. You'd think the guy who designs the hardware for Apple would be all into the hardware. But I'll tell you why he thinks software is important in a second. But first, a word from our sponsor, Rocket Mortgage. This is an example of how software can make your life better. Rocket Mortgage was created by Quicken Loans, number one, actually, technically the number two lender, more home mortgage lender in the country, $92 billion in loans. The other one is the big bank. And I have to tell you, I have experience with the big bank. With the last house we bought, we went to the big bank, you know, the ones with horses and stagecoach. And it took us more than a month to get a home loan. We had to first go to somebody who had this was 4 years ago. Crack me up. He had a calculator, a home amortization table calculator. He had a clipboard and a sheaf of papers with loans, and he'd go through them and say, well, let me just, this is what your payment would be. I mean, this thing, just that alone took like an hour. And then, okay, you got to fax us your pay stubs. You got to fax us your bank statements. And then they came back and said, well, we also need this and that. And we were faxing them stuff. We actually left on vacation, and we were still faxing them stuff. It was the worst experience ever. We almost lost the house because the seller said, when are you guys getting a loan? This is ridiculous. Fast forward, 2017, Quicken Loans, great company, number one in customer satisfaction, according to J.D. Power, year after year after year. They create something called Rocket Mortgage. It does away with all the pain points. So what they did is they created Rocket Mortgage, and the whole thing is online. In fact, so simple, you can do it on your phone. See? This comes back to like we're buying everything on our phone. You can get a home loan on your phone or a refi on your phone. And you don't have to go to the attic to get papers. You don't have to go to somebody with a calculator. It's because of computers. They do the whole thing online. So you go to rocketmortgage.com/twit2. Actually bookmark that. So if you're at an open house or you decide to buy at the spur of a moment, you can literally go to this website. Answer a few simple questions. They've got trusted partnerships with all the other financial institutions. So they pull what they need. You give them permission. They pull what you need. You decide what your term is, what your rate is, what your down payment is. They crunch the numbers. And based on your income, your assets, your credit, they will make you a home loan offer for a loan that's just right for you in minutes. Not a month, not weeks, not days, not hours, minutes. Like you could do this at an open house. And I love this button that says download the approval letter. You can if they still demand you have something in paper, you download it, you print the approval letter, you say, look, realtor, I'm approved. And I have to say that makes a big difference if you're house hunting. If you're the person out there who says, I'll be back to you in a month with my loan, or you're the person who says, no, we're already approved, who's going to get the house? RocketMortgage.com/twit2. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently with Quicken Loans and this 21st century tool called Rocket Mortgage. Equal housing lender license in all 50 states and MLSConsumerAccess.org number 3030. Rocket Mortgage. Bookmark this. You may need it. RocketMortgage.com/twit2. So, Jill, to your point about software, I read an interview with Johnny Ive, who's singing the praises, of course, of the new iPhone, the iPhone X. But he said, which is interesting, because this is the guy who does the hardware design, right? He said, the thing that's key on this is we can do everything in software. There's no physical button. In fact, I think Apple would love to get rid of all the physical buttons, even the lightning connector, and just have it be a slab of glass. He says, because software is infinitely configurable, can be changed at will. And I have to say, having used the iPhone X now, I wish even Android phones should adopt this swipe up to go home. You could swipe to previous applications by swiping along the bottom, swiping down from the left to get notifications, swiping down from the right to get settings. This is such a natural interface. I see what he means. It is software. The hardware has to be simple enough that the software can get the job done. So I think you're right about software. Long way around of saying that, but do you agree, Devendra? Have you used the iPhone 10? Do you agree about the UI?
I love. I'm loving the iPhone 10, but that's also after being really disappointed with Apple for so long, and I wonder how much of that is Johnny Ive's fault too, right?
You could point to a lot of dumb things Johnny Ive's done.
For sure, especially that dumb mouse that has to be charged from the bottom, things like that.
Yeah.
But like the iPhone Plus design never worked for me. I reviewed the first one, that was the 6 Plus, right? And it felt awful because all they did was blow up the existing, that particular iPhone design. So you still had the huge top and bottom bezels. It was just too big for your hands. The iPhone 10 at least feels like a good big screen phone. And the software is good. Those gestures are really nice, although I've had a lot of issues with, I don't think their software is doing that great.
Oh, there's lots of crashes.
Yeah.
And, I mean, iOS 11 is sad. That
and
it has
so
many
flaws.
The
new Mac OS X, it's all, Apple, I think, is kind of floundering when it comes to software, despite having this nice new interface.
I think the gestures are good, but I also think that I usually don't reveal traffic on our own site to particular stories. But the number one how-to of this entire year so far on Tom's Guide is how to close apps on the iPhone X. And if you have that many people searching for how to close applications on your phone, I think that's an issue. And I know there's a new interface, and I think I'm glad they went in the direction they did, but I think that's pretty telling.
Yes and no. I think what the problem is, you're not supposed to close apps on any phone, Android either.
Well,
that's a PC metaphor.
They still crash.
Yeah,
you sometimes still have to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so if they're frozen, I don't know what you do. But no,
I have on my iPhone, Twitter, sometimes even Spotify, things just stop working. So you have to do the whole pull up the app task, hold down one of the buttons, and then hit the minus button.
Oh, well, that's a flaw.
So you have to do that to redo it.
Okay, so force quit.
And that's always been
saying.
The case for iOS.
Yeah. I haven't seen that quite as much on the iPhone 10, so it hasn't come up for me. But you're right. It is non-intuitive how you do that. But I think, you have to swipe up, hold, then press and hold, and then press the X. It's ridiculous. But I think that comes from the fact that Apple's really saying, you don't want it. It's a mistake to close apps. You don't want to close apps in the like you would on a PC.
I mean, that came about. The whole idea of closing apps or not being a thing we should do, that came about when it comes to battery saving.
Right.
I remember when this whole thing started. And that's somewhat true, except when I go for a run with Runkeeper and it keeps using my location in the background. And the only thing I can do to stop it kill the app. There are still things you need to do to kill those. The other new interface on the iPhone 10 that I don't like, though, is the way you do Apple Pay and buy things through the iTunes store.
And that's a Face ID thing because you no longer have this home button.
Yeah.
So tell us.
Face ID, but you have to double click the power button, basically.
Right.
And if you mess up, you just turn off your phone and you go to sleep mode. It really doesn't. I've had to redo when I've been checking out so often because of that. Yeah.
This is an example.
But I thought turning.
Go ahead.
I thought turning off was different, though. I thought you had to press a couple buttons at the same time.
That goes to sleep mode.
He means sleep just mode. Shutting his screen off. Yeah.
Oh,
so
I see.
So this is really the problem with abandoning Touch ID and putting in Face ID. Is there a few edge cases like buying apps or logging into your bank where you need an additional gesture and you don't have a physical button anymore? So you have to overload the on-off switch in a way that really isn't good. I agree with you on that.
Yeah. But if you think about the overall direction of what Apple was trying to do with this device, you remember how much heat they took for those of us who were covering tech in 2007 for getting rid of the physical keyboard.
Right.
So
but
this
wait
is a
minute.
Continuation of that vision.
But Mark, surely you're not equating the headphone jack to the physical keyboard.
No. No, what I mean is getting rid of the home button is a continuation of the vision of making the iPhone basically all screen.
Right. Yeah, I like the UI, but I think you're right. You've come up with some issues that aren't quite solved yet.
I don't miss the home button, though. Not at all. Like, those bezels had to go, and this is probably the best way they could do it at this point.
Do you miss the headphone jack?
I do. I do miss that. Even though I have, like, I have Beats X, and a lot of my headphones are wireless, just when I'm in a car, I'm in a friend's car or something, and they don't have Bluetooth, you got to go with an aux jack. And if I forgot my little dongle,
it's ignoring,
you know,
it's
I have a $1,200 phone. Yeah. They can't do something, you know, a $50 phone can do. Right. It's ridiculous.
It's very annoying. Okay. Let's see where we should go. Actually, I have to say, and I've mentioned this before, but of course, Google has eliminated the headphone jack too on their Pixel 2s, which is just kind of stupidly, slavishly following Apple just because Apple thought it was a good idea. Thank goodness Samsung so far seems to want to keep the headphone jack. But then Google released the Pixel Buds, which were the worst abomination ever. And it's very disappointing. Because you need, you know, if you're going to take the headphone jack, you better have damn well have a good pair of Bluetooth headphones to go with it.
This was such a Me Too year for Google when it came to hardware. It's like, we got new phones, got new high-end phones. We got wireless headphones. So we've got stupid. Google Home. We've got so all this stupid. Stuff. And yeah, how much of it's actually good and useful? The Pixel XL, I'm so disappointed with that screen and all those issues.
Yeah.
I think this year has actually raised questions about Google's ability to create hardware, period.
I think you're right.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think you're absolutely right.
Because look at Google Home Mini. I mean, just like I did a joke on Twitter like a little while ago about you look up the definition of quality control and you get that emoji that's sort of like with the hands raised up in the air, like, I don't know.
Whatever. Whatevs.
But like, so like the Google Home Mini, they had to disable the touch controls, right? And then you have the Pixel 2 XL, which had the screen problems and also the audio issues. And it really just makes you wonder, like, are they internally testing this stuff?
They've
Has
never
Google
been great
ever
at hardware.
Had a really successful hardware launch?
Right.
I mean, I think Chromebooks have done okay, but Google
Chromecast?
Glass.
Chromecast was Google
Chromecast
Glass was
is their best one.
Chromecast was pretty good.
Chromecast is good. Yeah,
the only Chromebook Google has
which
made
is
was the Pixel.
Barely hardware.
Which are,
yeah, it's, I mean, you don't ever interface with the hardware. You plug it into your TV, and then it's software.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Google is the software company, right? They're doing all those camera tricks with software and not with like a second lens. So yeah, what Johnny Ive was saying is more about what Google is doing than what Apple's doing, honestly.
What do you all think about Amazon's hardware? I know this year marks like the 10-year anniversary of the e-reader.
The Kindle.
The Kindle.
I am like, such an idiot. I bought the hideously expensive new Oasis. $350 Kindle that is waterproof.
Well, you bought the LTE one for some reason.
I bought them all. I bought every
one
of them.
Come on,
what the hell's wrong with me?
Stop yourself. I reviewed all of Amazon's new hardware, and the new OS is it's at least a little cheaper. It starts at $250 now. The last one started at $280, but it's bigger than the last one, and I kind of liked how paper thin the last one was. So that's kind of weird. It's also inessential, right? Because the $120 Paperwhite Kindle has the same exact screen. It's only slightly heavier. The new Oasis is waterproof. That's kind of nice, but yeah,
it plays audible books, but not in the way you want it to. It just plays them like an audio player. It doesn't have any speakers, so you have
to, like your phone does.
Yeah, you pair it to Bluetooth. I was hoping it would do that really cool thing that some Kindles do, where as you're listening to the book, it highlights the text, so you're both looking. If you own both, you're both looking at the text and listening. Doesn't do that, which is the one thing it should do.
Yeah. And the new Echoes aren't that great. Like the cheap one, it's fine. It's cheaper, but it doesn't sound that good. And the Echo Plus sounds like marginally better than the original Echo.
You would think there's a huge opportunity for Apple with the HomePod, but they can't even make it.
No.
Yep.
And they've been focusing mostly on audio quality, which is great. But it seems like based on the stories that came out this week, I think it was Bloomberg that did that in-depth reporting.
Yeah, Gurman had this story,
Where it was like on again, off again. And by the time it came out, it was basically just a Me Too product in terms of the smarts. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a great GIF, by the way, but for the lead.
Yeah. Wow. That looks like something I'd have on my MySpace page circa 2005. I Wow.
Yeah, but it's but I think, you know, so Amazon is so much in the lead when it comes to like skills and smart home devices that their speakers work with. It's going to be really hard for Apple to catch up. And when you say, "Oh, wait, well, we have great audio quality," but guess what? So does the Sonos One,
right?
And it's $199.
Yeah. Right.
Those partnerships are going to be killer for Amazon. The Sonos One's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Sonos One, though. Okay, I like Sonos and as another product I have in every room, along with Echoes and Google Homes and all sorts of crap. But the Sonos One doesn't do everything that Echo, that Amazon Voice Services can do. For instance, it won't read me my Audible books.
Oh, man. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I hate it. This is all these companies have their silos. And they, you know, they preserve competitive advantage to the detriment of their end users, their customers. Customers, we need to stand up. We're just being manipulated by these companies. And it's really frustrating. Like, so clearly Amazon wouldn't let Sonos put in a full Amazon Voice Services, just a limited version.
That is pretty dumb, because what's more important to Amazon is you know, the platform, getting people on the platform and getting support for it. I can imagine that that's something they would maybe stop doing eventually. Like, there's a certain amount of control they want to have, except when they realize other people are making better hardware than them. What's the point of restricting things? Yeah.
I do love how Amazon has jumped on the secret agencies and have launched an Amazon Web Services secret region for the U.S. intelligence community. AWS secret region can run workloads up to the secret security classification level. And I guess I didn't know this. Did you know Amazon has a $600 million contract with the CIA for running top secret workloads on its cloud?
That seems...
What?
Yeah. Maybe they should, nothing can go wrong
maybe
with
they
that.
Shouldn't call it, maybe they shouldn't call it secret.
What? Yeah. What? Oh, okay. Just don't leave that back door to the iPhone up there, will you? Just keep that to yourself. Nobody, no one needs to know that. 10-year-old Kindle. Do you have a Kindle? You must. Come on, Jill. You've got a Kindle.
I don't.
Nope.
I think I had a Fire for a little while.
You're a reader. You're a writer. You got to be a reader.
Yeah. I kind of moved to the audio thing. You know, my eyes get so burned out looking at the screen all day. Yeah. Yes. I'm more of an audio person.
Oh, I'm glad to hear you say that, because every time I don't read paper anymore, and people, I feel like it's an old man thing, but no, you're a young person and you still use the audiobooks. I like audiobooks.
Yeah, I like audio.
I like somebody reading to me. But you're probably doing that while you're running and bicycling and doing active things like that. I just do it when I'm lying down. Jeff Bezos, by the way, now officially, for once and for all, the richest man in the world. 100.
You got to show the picture, dude. There.
Yeah. This has become a meme.
Actually, Basinator.
Yeah, he's buff. But then, of course, it was an internet meme, and there's all sorts of other images of him walking down, looking. But is this at the Allen? This might have been at the Allen Co. meetings. They put The Rock behind him, you know, also looking buff. Let me see if I can find that, because Bezos did an interview this week with his brother. And his brother and he, there you go. There's the picture with The Rock. And who's that other guy? That's
Vin Diesel.
Vin Diesel. Yeah.
Come on, Leo.
Bad and the Furious.
Yeah.
And so they actually, his brother put that up on the screen, and they were laughing. His brother, though, if you look at Jeff Bezos' brother, he's been hanging out at the gym. Well, let's see if I can find a picture of this. So he got his brother, as one would expect, got him to reveal a lot about himself. For instance, every summer from the time he was about 6 to the time he was about 17, Bezos would stop it. Autoplay video. He would go to his grandpa's pop, he called him, where there was nothing. There was no connectivity. Bezos spent his summers working on his grandfather's ranch in South Texas. He says, "I learned my resourcefulness from my grandfather." He tells some stories like the time his grandfather leapt. I don't know if I can do this story justice. Leapt out of the, he's driving the pickup truck off the ranch. He leapt out of the pickup truck. I've done this. Who doesn't? Trying to open the gate without stopping the truck so he can open the gate, jump in the truck and keep going. Accidentally, the truck runs into his hand, his thumb, and cuts off most of the top of his thumb. They rush to the hospital, and Pop, Jeff's grandfather, says, he's so mad. He says the thumb was hanging by a thread. He's so mad, he takes the thumb, rips it off, throws it into the bushes, goes to the hospital and says, I don't want my thumb reattached. Just take some skin from my butt and put it over the hole. And ever after, Bezos is telling the story, he'd have butt hair growing off his thumb that he had to, when he shaved, he would shave his thumb. And now you know how he's the richest man in the world.
I don't think the dots quite connect on that story.
Well, the point Jeff was trying to make is I learned resourcefulness from my grandfather. He bought a non-working combine. This is not Jeff. Jeff doesn't have the butt thumb. His grandpa has a butt thumb. He bought a non-working combine and said, Jeff, your job, Jeff is like 12, is to get that thing working. And they ordered parts, and Jeff worked on. Some of the parts were so big, they couldn't lift them. So Grandpa built a crane, a homemade crane, so they could lift the parts into the combine. He said, this is where I learned how you invent your way out of the box. He says, choosing his wife, same thing.
oh, jeez.
Should I stop? He says, he was doing the Dayton thing, like he had the app. He was doing the Dayton thing. And he said, I just want to find a woman who's resourceful so that, what was it? So that if I hurt myself, she can, I want to find this. It's just the funniest. If you get a chance, just read the interview. I guess that's the bottom line. And I'm not making up the story about the thumb.
Yeah, the moral of that story is throw away the thing that you really need when you're mad at it and then cover it with butt hair.
As a kid in Montessori school, Bezos describes how teachers would have to physically move his chair from one task. You know, at Montessori works. By the way, there's his brother who lifts even more than Jeff. Look at that. He was in Montessori school. You go from task station to task station. Jeff would get so focused that they had to actually pick up his chair and move it. He's not a fan of checking his phone at the dinner table. He's not big on multitasking. Even when it comes to his email, multitasking bothers me. If I'm reading my email, I just want to really be reading my email. Kids, that's how you become the richest man in the world.
Honestly, multitasking is mostly a crock, right?
It is. You can't really do it.
Focusing is better.
No, you can't really do it. By the way, I just want to mention that the Apple Watch, Jill, is one of Time Magazine's top 10 gadgets of 2017.
It's the person of the year.
Why?
It is. Well, it was, you know, they offered it person of the year probably, but the watch said, no, it's too much
work. It took too long to load, so it just
couldn't accept that. Number 9 on the list. Number 8, Xbox One X. 7, the Amazon Echo second generation. Number 6, the Super Nintendo Classic, which is sold out.
Something you can't even get, yeah.
Yeah. Samsung Galaxy S8, number 5, the DJI Spark, which is actually not my favorite. I would get the DJI Mavic Pro, which you can fold, but the Spark is a little cheaper. That was number 4. Number 3, your laptop, Jill, the Microsoft Surface laptop.
That's a good laptop.
Actually, you have the Microsoft Surface tablet, right?
No, the laptop.
Yeah, it's very nice. So you like
the glare is awful.
You like the fabric, the Alcantara?
No, the keys don't have enough springiness. The glare on the screen is just insufferable. If I, God forbid, I'm wearing glasses, like it doesn't know who I am. I have to take off the glasses to like unlock it with my face.
That keyboard, though, is better than most other laptops.
It's better than the crappy honestly. Apple MacBook.
What the hell are you doing, Apple? Like, I don't.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
Black keys.
Yeah, it's better than
the
MacBook.
I like some springy keys, though.
Get a Lenovo ThinkPad, Jill. You'll be happy. Yeah. You can thank me later. And they have them with matte screens. The best keyboard, really great for writers. And they have very good, you know, turnaround service, even in Bucharest. You know, you buy the... Seriously, you know who told me this? Cory Doctorow. And he says, I buy myself one luxury a year. It's a new ThinkPad. And when I buy the one-day replacement warranty, so if you have any problems, they come no matter anywhere in the world, in Bucharest, anywhere, they come. They either fix it or replace it that day. So you're never down for more than a day. And it's the writer's laptop. Now, he puts Linux on it. He immediately takes Windows off because he doesn't like Windows. But Corey says And I trust him so much, I actually went out and bought a ThinkPad T470S, and he's right. And you would like that. That's a good one. Look at the 470S.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually our top business laptop at Laptop Mac.
See? Oh, I forgot. I'm sitting next to the laptop expert. Yeah. Here I'm preaching away. I bought the X1 Yoga second generation, which I really like. That has, if you hate glary screens, you won't like it, though. It's an OLED screen. But no one could sneak up on you because you could see everything going on behind you perfectly.
Do you attach little side mirrors to it, too?
I don't want to be stuck up on. I have a number two, the Apple iPhone 10, according to Time Magazine. What do you think the number one gadget of 2017?
Fidget spinner.
Yeah. The Nintendo Switch. I think actually, I agree with that.
Yeah. That's a transformative device for sure.
Yeah.
It's innovative. And imagine, like, just a few years ago, a lot of people were writing off Nintendo as dead.
No kidding. You know,
that they never write off Nintendo.
Let's see. Just looking at other stories. I want to give you guys the best, not the weaker stories, just the best stories available. Do you want to talk about the education of Mark Zuckerberg? What is there to say about Facebook? I mean, Facebook is so powerful, and they're really coming, they're finally kind of admitting that they've got a problem with Russian interference and fake news. But do you think anything will change? We're coming up, believe it or not, there's an election in a year in the United States. And there's elections, many big elections coming up around the world that people are very concerned about Facebook's influence and the malign influence of the Russians using Facebook. Facebook is the perfect platform for them. Mark seems to want to, I don't know what he's up to. Here he is traveling. Here's at the Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina in March. He's kind of standing out like a sore thumb. He's got that glow about him. There's something about Mark. There's a glow. I don't know what it is. There's something a little strange. He might be an android. I don't know.
I mean, this whole year has been sort of his like presidential campaign.
30 right? states. He's visited 30 states. Mm-hmm. But I was giving him a hard time saying, oh, he's obviously running for president. And I have to say, Jeff Jarvis defended him and saying, well, look, if you run Facebook and you're in the bubble, you're living, in your mansion surrounded by empty houses that you bought so that you wouldn't have any neighbors, wouldn't it behoove you to kind of make an effort to go out in the real world, talk to normal people, see what Facebook, is doing right or wrong?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I
was just going to say, I think he's trying to, if Facebook is trying to become all about community and building communities, which is what this piece was about,
right,
about his education, then you do have to start at the grassroots level and also just sort of remember his own roots and what they were trying to build to begin with. Because I think, sometimes they've gotten away from what made them successful, and it's sort of just ballooned on them. And I think it's good to go out and actually talk to people and what they like and what they don't about the service so that they can improve it.
Jill, as a normal person, do you use Facebook?
Minimally.
How did I know?
Yeah.
Normal people use Facebook, though, right? I think they do.
Facebook definitely has a reputation now of being for older people. Young people are not on it. Young people do not engage on Facebook. But I think especially for the maybe 35, 40 and up crowd, that's all the activity. And, people my age like to share stuff about their kids.
Right.
That's fine. Like, that's a way for people to connect. And I do go on, I would say I go on once a day, just kind of check.
Well, that's a lot.
Messages. Yeah. I mean, for like 5 minutes just to see.
So my daughter's 25 and confirming what you said, she did use Facebook a lot to stay in touch with people. But I think she decided it was kind of a negative way of staying in touch and she wants to delete it.
Yeah, I understand. Like, it definitely has its problems, and people who are savvy about the web see it as kind of this weird sinkhole. You know, you go into Facebook, and there's not a lot of clicking outside of Facebook, right? Like, you kind of get sucked into just being there. And I think people who are a little more savvy about how the internet works see that that's unusual, right? Like, usually we're linking out to a million things. We're going places. We're finding new information. Right. Whereas Facebook is really parochial.
Are kids using Instagram? Because that's all.
Oh, yeah.
Also
oh, yeah.
Facebook.
Yeah,
that's the that's the replacement for most young people?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
or Snapchat.
I have a 13-year-old, and she doesn't use Facebook. She uses Insta and Snapchat.
Is that what they call it, kids? They call it Insta? I'll Insta you.
I guess.
Does she prefer Snapchat or Insta?
Instagram more, but I think when it comes to communication, it's mostly over Snapchat. And then you have iMessage too, which is sort of like how they get into the whole, you know, tech to begin with.
Right. So I, when Abby, my daughter, asked me that, I said, well, you can deactivate your account, then you have to wait 3 months, and then maybe they'll delete the data and so forth. But I was wrong. And I think this is thanks to GDPR, the German data protection, the European data protection rules that are going into effect early next year. You can now permanently delete your Facebook account. Boom. Before you do this, they say you may want to download a copy of your info. They give you a link to do that. If you'd like to delete your account permanently, no option for recovery, you can do it. Log into your account and let us know. When you delete your account, people won't be able to see it on Facebook. It may take up to 90 days from the beginning of the deletion process to delete all the things you've posted, like photos, status updates, and other data stored in backup systems. While we're deleting this information, it is inaccessible to other people using Facebook. And things you do on Facebook that aren't in your account, like messages to other people, those will live on. But there it is. There's the button, delete my account. If you would like your account deleted, we'll take care of this for you. No reactivation, no recovery. You're gone. Gosh, should I click that? Should I click that button? What could possibly? Let me just see what happens. Oh, you're about to. Are you sure? Fill in the following: your password and a CAPTCHA. I feel like I probably should stop here.
Wow, or you make a terrible mistake. Yeah,
I don't know. It's irrevocable. But this is and by the way, so kudos to GDPR, because Facebook would never have done this unless they were forced to do this.
This is what, like, government oversight and all that
there
stuff.
There you go.
Like, it's very helpful. Yeah.
There you go.
But this solves, like, a problem. It's definitely nice that this feature is there, but I think the bigger problem we're seeing now with Facebook is sort of like the way they're managing news and, yeah, the way people are getting information from it and their lack of human editorial. Who knows how much that affected the election. It seems like a lot, for sure.
Supposedly, by the end of the year, within another month, there will be a tool you can use in the Facebook Help Center that will let you know if you liked a Facebook page that just happens to have been created by the Russians. Because you don't know, right? So it's going to create a portal to enable people on Facebook to learn which of the Internet Research Agency's Facebook pages, of which there were many, right? There were hundreds. Mm-hmm. Or Instagram accounts they may have liked or followed. And they didn't look like they were Russian. It wasn't like it was in Cyrillic or anything. They looked like, they tried to look like, anyway, Americans. Although a lot of them were pretty obviously fake. Is that enough? I don't know if that's enough.
No. Like, I think Facebook keeps trying to say that their new algorithms will save us from their older algorithms.
Yeah.
And definitely after the election, we're seeing we need more general oversight. We need more editorial oversight from Facebook, and also more, honestly, more security controls, too. Like, you know, these organizations creating these groups, it feels like the sort of thing they should be tracking already.
I mean, what I'd like to know is what ads did I see that were Kremlin-sponsored?
Exactly.
For
that,
instance,
too.
You know. And what were those ads for those I didn't see, those dark ads, like to see what those looked like? That would be an eye-opener. Supposedly they're getting those together. I hope they do that. Facebook's first investor, Peter Thiel, at least according to the movie, and that's all I know about Facebook, the social network, he gave Mark Zuckerberg $500,000 when Mark was trying to grow Facebook beyond the Harvard University campus. He sold 3/4 of his stake. He's not getting out of Facebook. He sold $29 million worth of shares. That's pretty good for $500,000. He's sold a total of $1 billion worth of its stock, and he still owns a little bit. I don't know if this is meaningful, although it may have something to do with the fact that Peter Thiel is now suing to get the right to buy Gawker's remaining assets so he can delete the bad articles about him forever and ever.
Yeah, so he could be raising money for that opportunity.
Could be. I don't think it'll cost that much.
Isn't the damage already done, though?
Damage is done. Of course, I don't have to tell you. I probably don't have to tell you, but I will anyway. Teal, you know, was mad at Gawker because they outed him in an article some time ago and got his revenge when Hulk Hogan was suing Gawker for publishing a sex tape of Hulk Hogan. Hulk sued in Florida court, and we found out after he won that Peter Thiel had funded the lawsuit. So the lawsuit gave a fair, I think it was $100 million-plus award to Hulk Hogan, which basically bankrupted Nick Denton, the owner of Gawker. He had to sell Gawker to Univision, but the assets, I didn't know this, the assets, the website, the bad article about Peter Thiel and many other people still is online. Thiel initially couldn't buy it. There was a provision that prevented him from buying the assets. He put him out of business, and then he wanted to buy the assets. That's a standard move in the United States. But he's now filing a motion saying, I want to buy those assets. And I think it's safe to assume that his real purpose is just to burn it to the ground so that nobody can
see.
It's
not just that article, too. Like, Gawker was always reporting on he made a lot of bad investments and a lot of bad calls. And they were one of the few sites to, like, really chart that progression.
I'm sure as journalists, you guys, you know, regret Peter Thiel and what he was able to do by virtue of his vast fortune, put a journalistic entity out of business. But I never
I grew up watching Hulk Hogan on TV. I did not know that because of him, you know, Gawker would be destroyed and all of that.
But have we really lost anything that bad?
We've definitely lost a certain voice. And, you know, I didn't read Gawker every day, but it was nice having that sort of like dissenting independent media outfit. And, you know, we're seeing like we're talking about all these different outlets being bought up by bigger organizations. Gawker was at least independent, and we don't really have that on the tech side at this
point.
That's
a good point.
Yeah.
There was also some unionization efforts going on there that I think were pretty progressive compared to a lot of other media outlets, and actually changed the way some sites in New York did their business because of what they saw. Yeah.
And Nick didn't fight that?
My guess is that I don't think he did. I think he actually embraced it.
That's good for him. All right. We shall see. We shall see what happens to the remains of Gawker. It would be kind of, I don't want to say poetic, but it's an interest. You know, here's a guy who doesn't like a site, spends millions putting it out of business, and then buys the assets so he can burn it.
It is definitely the cherry on top of the story of the destruction.
It's very
of media.
Shakespearean.
Like, definitely, yeah. Yeah.
Let's take a break. We will have lots more. Jill Duffy is here from PC Magazine. We're almost our farewell before you leave for Bucharest. That's so romantic. I'm off to Bucharest. Do you have a steamer trunk? Or are you going to take a boat? You should take a boat.
Oh, darling. The boat's been booked for ages.
Oh, my God. We're going to take the Queen Mary across the pond to Bucharest. Also here, of course, the great Devendra Hardwar, senior editor in Gadget, and a new guy. We're thrilled to have Mark Spoonhour he's editor-in-chief of Tom's Guide and the Laptop Magazine. We had a great week this week on the network on Twit, and we've prepared a little promotional video for your delectation watch.
Previously on Twit.
I don't mean to alarm you, but you've got a turkey hovering over your head.
I'm thankful that there's a TV in between me and the bottom of that turkey.
Yeah.
And 3,000 miles.
You don't want a real turkey falling on you.
All about Android.
We are welcoming to the show a very awesome guest, Kyle Kang, who is the global head of marketing for OnePlus.
We have the most, I think, knowledgeable critical users who are knowledgeable of technology. But we believe we need to deliver devices that meet that standard. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's probably our philosophy.
The new screensavers.
Just in case you didn't have enough food, this is going to be kind of an interesting episode. We're also going to show you some Internet of Things cooking devices. We're going to have some fun. We're going to do some sous viding and beer tasting and all that. You see how nicely roasted that's getting? It actually gives it a very nice finish. Now it's Instagram ready.
Twit. It's what's for dinner.
I love it. In our chat room, Missing is saying, why pay for all that stuff when you just get, you know, like a toaster oven and a pot of water for nothing? If you have to ask that question, you're watching the wrong show.
That's a Jill Duffy question. I got something else you can spend some money on. Something else that's Internet of Things enabled. Our molecule. I love our molecule air purifier. It's the first molecular air purifier. Now, I've always been skeptical about these HEPA filter air purifiers, and I never bought one. But then along came the molecule, and Lisa, who has been plagued by headaches ever since we moved to the country, lots of pollen, says her headaches are gone. Because it's not just a HEPA filter. The problem with HEPA filters is they're not fine enough. This was invented in the 40s. There haven't been any innovations since. They're not fine enough to get pollutants, things like black mold and volatile organic compounds. The molecule is. The molecule uses photoelectrical chemical oxidation, or PECO, to go beyond the HEPA filter, capture and eliminate allergens, mold, bacteria, viruses, airborne chemicals, pollutants 1,000 times smaller than those a HEPA filter can capture. And I have to tell you, it works. One customer said, after 15 years, I can finally breathe through my nose. I have to say, I've not been congested since we got the molecule. We have it in our bedroom. Now I want to get one for the studio because it doesn't just get, you know, dust and pollen. It gets organic compounds. It gets black mold. If you live in an office, you know, work in an office where they don't open the windows, you know, that sick office complex, this fixes it. Molecules technology was funded by the EPA. It's been tested not only by real people, but university laboratories like the University of South Florida's Center for Biological Defense and the University of Minnesota's Particle Calibration Laboratory. It's easy to use. It has a slick, clean design. Really looks beautiful. And with a solid aluminum shell. And I love this. Now, you don't have to use this feature, but you pair it to your smartphone, and it will monitor your filters and automatically send you new filters automatically when you need them. So you don't even have to think about it. It has two kinds of filters. It has an air filter, but it also has this really interesting substrate that is a catalyst. And the VOCs, the very fine particles, the black mold, adhere to the catalyst, and then they're burned off by, and you can see the blue light from the molecule. They're actually burned off by the blue light so that you never breathe them in. It's the Apple of air purifiers. You can collect, now you can, but you don't have to connect molecule to your Wi-Fi network, which means I can control it. In fact, I can turn my molecule off and on from here. But you don't have to, some people say, oh, I don't want an IoT device. You can just use it as a regular air purifier. There's a switch on the top. You can control it completely. We have been blown away by this, and I want to get one for every room in the house, and I want to get one from the studio, too. Right now, you can get $75 off your first order at molecule.com. If you use the promo code TWIT, they will also, I think, check, but I think that you also get a free year subscription to filters. It is a really remarkable system. And by the way, if you don't pair it with your Wi-Fi, if you don't connect it to the Bluetooth, they'll still do the filter subscription, but they just send it on a regular, you know, monthly basis as opposed to when it's needed. That's the only difference. It is amazing. I want at least go to molekule.com and check it out. Molekulewithak.com and read about it. And I will testify. It works. Lisa will testify. She hasn't had a headache. And in fact, I took the molecule out of the room once, and she had a headache the next day. And she said, what'd you do? I said, oh, it's going back. Molekule.com. Use the promo code TWIT. It's molecule with a K. And it really works. I've turned down a lot of what I consider kind of sketch purifier products, ionizers and stuff. We don't want to do ads for those. And I, even before we did the ad for the molecule, I said, no, I have to have it. I have to use it. I have to make sure it really does what it says it does. And I did all the research, and I have to say, this is the one I was willing to advertise. This really does work. I know it's a little expensive. With $75 off, it's really worth it. Molecule.com. Use the offer code TWIT. Let's see. Anything to say about Twitter? Is it all, you like the 280 characters? You happy? Everybody loving the TweetStorm feature? I guess it's testing a TweetStorm feature. I don't have that yet.
I haven't seen that.
I don't want to encourage TweetStorms. Let's not encourage TweetStorms. I don't like TweetStorms. That's a bad idea. I'm seeing people who are effectively writing blog posts as multiple, like 20 thing tweets. What? Why would you do that? Nobody. You maybe some people will see it that day, and then it's gone forever.
I think the whole point of Twitter is the brevity of it.
Yes,
and I feel like we're getting away from that.
Yes. Actually, my friend Dave Weiner has an application called Pork Chop that will make tweet storms automatically for you as well. But I don't recommend it. And now with 280 characters, really, you could write your next novel on Twitter, Jill. Do you have a novel in your drawer? I know you do.
No.
Next to the bottle of bourbon? No, come on. Every writer has a novel.
No.
Do you ever think about writing fiction, or would you prefer you prefer nonfiction?
I'll tell you, one of the worst insults I ever heard was I published a book a few years ago called Get Organized, How to Clean Up Your Messy Digital Life.
Love that book.
My father said, but when are you going to publish a real book?
Oh.
And then he told me how much he loves John Grisham. And I was like, all right, Dad.
No, you just see, he ruined it with the Grisham thing.
Yeah,
ruined it. I don't see you as a Grisham type. I could see you though more as a Agatha Christie. You could write. I bet you write great. Why don't you write like tech mysteries set in Bucharest? That'd be great.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that's my jam.
Does Dad ever say, when are you going to get a real job?
No, I don't know. I don't know if he knows what I do.
I'm willing to bet none of our parents know what we do. Yeah.
He's an odd duck. He lives in Reno, Nevada, and he's a taxi driver, and he always loves to tell me stories about all the people who come in for Burning Man.
Oh my God.
He's the one who drives them from the Reno airport out into the desert.
Oh, there's a story there. Your dad is a taxi driver in Reno that drives people to Burning Man.
He's cuckoo bananas. I think you would like him.
I think I love him already. We're probably the same age. Elon Musk, a big event announcing the electric semi-truck. We now know the price. I'm tempted. It didn't cost much more than my Model X. $150,000. That's nothing for a semi. Yeah,
take Twitter on the road, Leo.
I'm so tempted. I could trade in my Model X, just throw in a couple of, maybe 10 grand more, and I'd have a semi. Doesn't include
the thing I love
that's
about,
just the cab, right? You don't get the truck part.
That I love most about this is not so much the efficiency, but the promise or guarantee that it won't jackknife. And as someone who commutes from New Jersey to New York every day,
yeah,
I would love to see more trucks and less accidents.
Yeah. There is, though, and I read an article, was it Bloomberg? Might have been an auto journalist, where people are starting to say, Elon's making promises that current technology can't support, like that truck.
He's always been doing that. Yeah.
It's time. This is Mashable, Forbes saying the same thing. It's time for Elon to stop making promises he can't keep. Lance Ulanoff writing in, actually, this was last month, so I'm going to see if I can find a more recent one. Mashable writes, Elon Musk, master of deception. Did Elon Musk lie to us? They say, this is from a website called Seeking Alpha. Who are you going to believe, Elon Musk's words or your own lying eyes? So I'm one of those people who kind of buys the Kool-Aid. And one of the problems people say is this truck can't possibly exist with current battery technology, the 500 mile range, the acceleration and the Roadster is even more challenging. And then they can't even build a Model 3 because it turns out the Gigafactory, the battery plant he built next to your dad in Reno, isn't cranking out the batteries. His newest promises break the law of batteries. Carson, where is that article? That's the one I'm talking about. Break the law of batteries. Let me Google that. But I for one, want him to succeed. Yeah, it's in Bloomberg.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Randall. So what do we think? Is he just, is he a huckster? Is he a showman? Is he aspirational?
I mean, we've since the beginning, right, since he started doing SpaceX and Tesla, a lot of his ideas have been out of reach, but to the point where it almost like collapsed the business, right? I think Tesla was in trouble for a very long time, as was SpaceX. But he proved certain things were possible, right? He got the cars out there. SpaceX is doing what they're doing, shuttle deliveries. They've proved their relaunching capabilities. But yeah, I wonder if he's going too far at this point, for sure.
Yeah, I think one of the more troubling things is just the fact that they can't build enough Model 3s and get them out the door, because that was supposed to be like their one car that was supposed to be not for the masses, but it's the closest to being for the masses. And if you can't live up to those promises, it doesn't almost matter what the other promises he's making about battery technology and that sort of thing. It's like you got to deliver on something that is going to be in more driveways, and he's not getting it done so far.
Yeah. Even if Tesla, Bloomberg writes, achieves record-breaking efficiency for the truck, it would still require, and by the way, Tesla claims the truck is more aerodynamic than a sports car, but even if Tesla achieves record-breaking efficiency for the truck, it would still require a battery capacity somewhere from 600 to 1,000 kilowatt hours. Say it's 800 kilowatt hours. That would mean a battery that weighs more than 10,000 pounds, a 5-ton battery. The battery alone would cost $100,000 even before you build the truck around it. And he's claiming the truck will be $150,000. And then, in order to charge it, you need to build something that doesn't exist, the mega charger. An electric vehicle analyst at Bloomberg says, I don't understand how that works. I really don't. A charger that can charge this truck 400 miles of range in 30 minutes. To meet Tesla's claim, mega chargers would have to achieve an output of more than 1,200 kilowatts. That's 10 times more than the superchargers they're making today. So, but you know what? I would not bet against Elon Musk. And so far, the stock market hasn't. Although his burn rate, what was the number? Mm-hmm. It was like $1 billion a month or something. Crazy burn rate. He's at that rate, he's going to run out of money. He's going to have to go back and get more money fairly soon. So I don't know. The stock market still loves Tesla, and I still love Tesla. And actually, when I read this story, I'm almost embarrassed to admit I put $1,000 down on a Model 3 because I gosh darn it,
Leo.
Well, okay. It said you won't get it for 18 months. I figure by then they'll figure it out, right?
I feel like your next show is a self-help tech show.
I need help. I definitely
make it stop.
Please, Jill, make it stop.
I think the one thing I do like about Elon Musk is he has really branded himself as the crazy inventor.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. I think of him more as Hank Scorpio than I do an entrepreneur. Like, you know, Hank Scorpio from The Simpsons, right? Like he's just this crazy wacko, possibly super villain, possibly evil genius. Yes. We're not really sure yet. But I think that's part of what he does when he overpromises, is he continues branding himself as somebody who shoots for the moon and is unabashedly enthusiastic about his own dreams. And I think that plays a lot into the American psyche.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I love him. Now we gotta wrap up pretty soon because HQ is coming up at 6 o'clock and it's an $8,000 prize today, and today's gonna be my day. Do you, any of you play this game?
A bit.
I don't even know
not
what it
very
is.
Much.
Last time I played a couple of nights ago, 142,000 people. It's a live trivia game. It's nothing special, frankly, but somehow it's captured people's imagination. Maybe it's because they give away real money.
Mm-hmm.
142,000 people were playing, was it last night or the night before, for $1,000. But the questions are really hard. You have to answer all 12 correctly, and then whoever's left will split the pot. And I've seen people win $100. I mean, you know, it's real money. You get a PayPal credit. But the star of the show, Scott Rogowski, is actually a guy who was a comic in Manhattan for a decade. Was about to leave. He was about to move away, give up on his dreams, when he got the audition call for HQ, and he has now become a star. And the Daily Beast wanted to write a profile of this guy. So they contacted HQ, and the founder of HQ, who's the former Vine founder, Russ Yusupov, said, no, can't talk to him. But the Beast went ahead and called Scott. They actually sent an email to Scott and Russ. Russ's response was no. Scott contacted him. So they went and they interviewed him. and chatted with the Daily Beast. They, at that point, the reporter reached out to the HQ public relations account and Russ Yusupov, letting him know that they plan to write a story about the host. Several hours later, received an email from Yusupov stating HQ was not making Scott available to discuss his involvement with HQ, with the media, or the press. So the reporter said, well, we already interviewed him. The story is almost done. Let us know if you have any concerns. This did you guys read this? It's hard not to just...
Oh, yeah.
Laugh.
Wait, so did they go to HQ first?
They simultaneously went to HQ and Scott.
Okay.
HQ turned him down, but Scott said, all right. So, hey, good reporter. He said, okay, good. Let's meet.
Yep.
Yusupov, the CEO of HQ, called the reporter's cell phone and immediately raised his voice. He said, we were completely unauthorized to write about Scott or HQ without his approval, and that if he wrote any type of piece about Scott, I will fire him. Yusupov continued to threaten Scott's job even after the Daily Beast explained the story is framed around his daily life. It revealed no corporate information. You're putting Scott's job in jeopardy. Is that what you want? Yusupov said Scott could lose his job. Read me your story word for word or you can email it to me. The reporter says, although we don't typically share the contents of our pieces, we did share quotes from Rogowski. Yusupov's objections began with a line. Scott said that despite his attention, he's still able to walk down the street and order his favorite salad from Sweetgreen without being accosted. He cannot say that, Yusupov shouted. We do not have a brand deal with Sweetgreen. Under no circumstances can he say that. Anyway, the piece ended up being about Russ Yusupov threatening to fire Rogowski. Yusupov backed down and, in fact, has now tweeted an apology saying he was, you know, being a crazy startup guy and the stress was getting to him and sorry. But I think what's interesting is that when Scott is not on HQ... If you watch the chat room, people go crazy. They have some other hosts they use. Scott has become a real celebrity, and I think he has enough power at this point that I don't think he's going to get fired. Just a funny, funny story. Nothing much to say about it.
It's just kind of sad, too, because that guy, this isn't his first startup.
He should know better.
He's the founder of Vine. He should know better. Yeah, not sure. And this is honestly a trend I've been seeing with more and more tech companies, is that they start to see the press as... another arm of their PR,
right?
Basically, and they don't understand how press actually works, and it's just kind of sad to see.
So, but Russ realized how not only the optics were. I think maybe he even realized he'd gone over the top. Here's his tweet from a few days ago: "Who's a cliche stressed out startup founder? Me, Scott Rogowski." And there's a picture of him eating a salad with Scott at Sweetgreen. And he tweets, Sweetgreen is great. I've never been to Sweetgreen, but obviously that's the place to go in New York. If you're ever in New York.
It's all right.
You've been there.
Hey, they're all over the place.
Russ also tweeted, looking for a good PR agent. DM me if interested.
See, at least he admits it.
You know what? That's the way to handle it. I'm an idiot. Yeah. That's the way to handle it. And, you know, all around, good PR, because you never heard about HQ, Jill, and now you probably just... can't wait in 45 minutes to play for that big $1,000.
I'm at least gonna read the story.
Do you like trivia? Because I love trivia.
I like trivia when I'm with some of my friends who just lead the most exotic, bizarre lives and have a wealth of knowledge that I cannot begin to conceive
like
of
fun.
Myself.
I want to hang out with you.
Because I like to be on the winning team, but I'm not very good.
Ah. Yeah, this is hard because they start easy to suck you in, and then about question five they start asking things like what I don't know. What no one knows that. Intel, golly, this is a sad story. Has found more bugs in the management engine. This is a feature, the Intel management engine on a lot of PCs. Pretty much every PC it's built in. It's not active on non vPro PCs. However. There are 8 severe bugs in the IME, the Trusted Execution Engine, and the Server Platform Services. And as we've talked about on Security Now, turns out they can be utilized. You can be attacked. They can be exploited through the USB port. So you can plug in a device called a JTAG programmer into the USB port and completely own the machine. So many people are now starting to get firmware updates. I know the Lenovo's has pushed those out. Other manufacturers are planning to push those out, updates to the Intel management engine that fix the problem. There were a lot of people concerned about the fact that this, basically it's an operating system. It's a Minix operating system sitting in your PC that was designed, you know, I guess for remote management. And, of course, anytime there's something like that in a machine, bad guys are going to take advantage of it.
And I think the worst thing about that is that, like, at first, like, when we heard about the news, we're like, oh, it's only, you know,
only vPro.
It's not really consumer. Yeah. But then, like, those are definitely the machines that you want to protect because they typically have, like, the most sensitive information on them, the business-oriented PCs.
Yeah, and I don't know. It's my sense, Mark, and I don't know. Maybe you know better that these new exploits – it doesn't have to be a vPro machine because it's not going through the Ethernet, through the internet connection. It's going through the USB port. And so it could take advantage of the management engine even if it's not active. I don't know.
Yeah, I had heard it was mostly enterprise-oriented systems, but okay. I don't know if you guys heard it any different.
Yeah, I'm not clear on that. Anyway, it's something to be aware of. And I do know that I got firmware updates. Do you know, Lenovo's pushing them out. I heard Dell was saying they were going to be pushing them out. I imagine everybody will be soon.
Yeah, HP.
Uber, we found out, not only did it reveal that they hid a 2016 breach back when Travis Kalanick was CEO, but they actually paid off the hackers their $100,000 ransom and then made them sign an NDA saying they would never tell anybody about it. Of course, that's a violation of the law. You're legally supposed to report breaches. 7 million drivers, 50 million riders. The drivers lost driver's license information, the rider's account information, but not credit card numbers or anything like that. The security officer in charge at the time, Joe Sullivan, was fired when the new CEO learned about this. But the latest story is the new CEO might have known a lot sooner. Took him a while to figure out what to do about it. I think they had to reveal it. I think not doing so would have made them liable. Sullivan's fired. Kalanick is on the board, but of course is not an active manager. He's not the CEO anymore. Dara Khosrowshahi, you better help me with his name. Am I saying it right? Khosrowshahi? Dara Khosrowshahi said he only recently learned of the breach, although the latest I've seen is that he's known about it for a couple of months.
Oof.
Yet another problem at Uber. I still use Uber. I'm sorry. I feel bad about it, but
is there a reason you still use it compared to like
Lyft
or something?
Cheap and convenient. I don't know. Should I? Is Lyft as good?
Lyft is fine. Lyft is just as good. Most drivers use both. Yeah,
same drivers. Same cars, same drivers. Okay, I'll use Lyft. You convinced me.
But yeah, it's at this point, like Uber clearly just always thinks it's above the law and doesn't want to follow typical consumer protection rules. Right. So there you go.
Quick break. We'll wrap things up. Got to get going for HQ. Jill Duffy's here from PC Magazine. I want to ask you about your language training, how you're learning Romanian in a second.
Okay.
Also with us, first time. I think he's a keeper. Mark Spoonhour, great to have you, editor in chief, Tom's Guide and Laptop Magazine. M Spoonhour on the Twitter. M S P O O N A U E R. So, you probably heard this before, but isn't he a character on one of those cartoon shows, Spoonhauer?
That's Boomhauer.
Oh, Boomhauer. Okay, never mind. He's a guy that's like this, right?
Oh, I know that.
Yeah. What's the name? King of the Hill. King of the Hill. That's not you. No,
I try to enunciate a little bit more.
click. also Devendra Hardawar. Our show today brought to you by one of the best things I've ever done. I got to say, I don't have it here. I don't have my fractures here. I print our photos on glass now. You, Jill Duffy, should check this out. This is what you want. So we all are taking beautiful pictures, but the problem is they're on hard drives. They're on Google Photos or on Apple Photos. You know, they're not visible. But you have a beautiful picture. I bet you have many beautiful pictures that you should be hanging on the wall. This is the best way to print them. Fracture. Fracture is a photo decor company that wants to rescue your favorite images from the digital ether. Yeah, bring me the big one. This is my favorite one. Just upload your digital photo, pick your size. They have all sorts of sizes ranging from 4.8 by 6.4 inches all the way up to this one. Look at this, 21.6 by 28.8. Giant. And I'll tell you what, that picture pops because of the glass printing. It looks, the colors, the contrast just come out big time. And it comes ready to hang. It's mounted I don't know what you call this, poster board? No, it's like foam core. And then it has a hanger, and it even comes with a screw all in the box, so you're ready to hang it up. Here's the little one. This is an example of a little one. These are great. This is how it comes in the shipping in the box. You pop it out. You see it's got the screw, and it's got the little hanger on the back of the foam core. And they hang on your wall so beautifully. You can get them with borders. You get to choose the border, the color, or you can get them borderless if you want. They have a cropping tool, an advanced photo editor. And this is a great holiday gift. In fact, I'm giving a bunch of these of the kids to grandma. Beat the holiday rush, though. Don't wait too late. Fracture's order queue fills up fast this time of year. So now's the time to go to fracture.me and use the offer code TWIT15 to get 15% off your first order. Bring a special memory to life. It would be a wonderful gift for parents and family and friends. Or decorate your home with moments to tell your story. But now is the time if you want to get it in time for Christmas. They are handmade in the U.S., Gainesville, Florida, U.S. source materials. It's a carbon neutral factory, or fractory, as you will. Fracture.me. Use the offer code TWIT15 for 15% off your first order. And there's a quick one-question survey where they'll ask where you heard about it. And if you put This Week in Tech, I would be eternally grateful to help support the show. Fracture.me. The offer code is TWIT15. I think right now for Black Friday, Cyber Monday, they have a 30% off on gift cards. So you could, I guess you don't have to give the photo, you give the gift card. But I think the photo is really what people want. Fracture.me. Jill Duffy, we're going to lose you to Romania. Can you still call us once in a while from Romania?
Yeah.
They got Skype?
Yeah, they got good internet speeds there, too.
Do they really?
Yeah, I mean, it's all over Europe tends to be better than the United States.
Isn't that sad?
Yeah.
So you want to speak Romanian, which I'm very impressed with, because I would just hang out with Americans and speak English the whole time. But
yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah, so I'm doing this very intensive course. I'm in week number 12.
It's a romance language, right?
It is a romance language. It's the closest living language to Latin.
Wow.
So it's tough. There are some hard things about it, but it gave me such a different perspective to learn in this intensive environment as opposed to learning through language learning software, which is something I've been covering and writing about for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years now. What my real conclusion is that software can give you a good base and it can help you practice, but it really doesn't ever teach you some of the hard things that you can't get without another person. And any software program is never going to claim to give you fluency. That's something that you need to have interaction with real human beings to get. But it's just given me a different way of thinking about software as kind of an additive product to doing a class or some kind of course.
So there is, and I've used Duolingo.
Duolingo's great.
There are these, you know, kind of more traditional, Rosetta Stone is big, Pimsleur. All of them
I
have.
I love Pimsleur. Pimsleur's kind of old, but it's audio based, and it was designed. The name comes from this linguist who was studying how do we make language stick in the brain. And this guy, Dr. Pimsleur, came up with a theory about how often you need to repeat and recall something. So Pimsleur is very rigid in that you listen to one file per day, and every so many days it will ask you to recall something you did, say, 2 days ago. So it's all about triggering the memory. Right now, one of the apps I really like is called 50 Languages. No, I'm sorry, not 50 Languages. HelloTalk. And HelloTalk pairs you up with somebody who speaks the language you want to learn and vice versa. And then you can practice with one another and send each other corrections while you're chatting.
Oh, that's
cool. So I've actually met a number of people who live in Romania and Moldova and are actually young people who speak the language on the street. And that's been a wonderful way to just kind of exercise it a little bit.
So it's like a Skype connection? I mean, how are you talking to them?
Mostly it's text chat.
Oh, it's text chat.
Just like,
okay.
It's just like a messaging app, but there are some functions where you can copy the text that somebody has said and then provide corrections to them, and they'll show up in red and green. And I think it does have some functionality if you want to have an audio call or a video call with somebody, but it also has some good permissions in place to protect your privacy if you don't want to have interaction with strangers on that level.
So it sounds like you use a variety of tools.
Yeah. There's another one, actually, something you said earlier about reading and wanting to hear the audio of something while you have the text highlighted. There's an app called Bilingua app. It doesn't have Romanian, so I was using it in Spanish, but it does exactly that. It will highlight the words in Spanish as you read. And then if you choose to see the English too, you can see the English translation all while playing the audio of the Spanish. And you can find articles online that are about tech or society and culture or whatever you have an interest in. And then you can kind of practice your reading skills that way.
How do you spell Bilingua?
B-E-E, Bilingua app.
Oh, like a bumblebee and lingua, yeah. Like a language. Cool, Bilingua app.
Bilingua app.
Oh, so this is for reading, not speaking.
Yeah.
Neat.
But reading is a good way to kind of expand your vocabulary.
Right. And I think it's actually helpful to see the words. And you can hear them too, right? Because a lot of times if I'm learning a language from audio alone, I like to see the word because then I can associate the two. And I don't know why, but I feel like that's a better way to learn it for me. Maybe that's just my style.
Sometimes it helps. Sometimes it doesn't help if you don't know the how the pronunciation works in the script yet.
But that's how you learn, right?
Yeah, well,
maybe.
For some language, right, like some languages that have a totally different script than what we use in English, you kind of need to learn that first before you can bridge into.
So Duolingo offers Romanian. Mm-hmm. Do you use that from time to time as well, or...?
I have used it a little bit, but my class went so quickly.
Yeah.
That
you could. Oh, yeah. You know, I had that problem. I was because we were about to go to France and I was just brushing up with Duolingo and it was slow compared to I could have gone faster.
You have to test out if you want
right.
to go to higher levels.
Yeah. And I kept learning participles or something. It was like, come on, let's move on. Look at that. You got a lot of diacritical marks there. A lot of. Wow. But it is kind of, if you know Latin, you can kind of see in tot deona.
Tot deona.
What does that mean?
I think it means always.
Always. In tot deona. Oh, yeah. And every day, deona. Sure. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. See, I'm already learning Romanian thanks to you. Jill, good. Can we continue to see your stuff at PC Magazine?
Absolutely.
Anywhere else we can look for you?
You know, I've written a couple articles lately for TooManyAdapters.com, which is a really fun. It's a really fun little website about traveling and kind of
technology for travelers. You're perfect for that. And I, you know, as somebody who loves to travel, in fact, did you write this 5 of the best language apps, which is right for you?
I did.
Well, I'll be damned. We just went through it. Here it is. Look at that.
Yeah.
Very nice. TooManyAdapters.com. So good to see you, Jill. And keep biking. Keep away from that technology. It's not going to do you any good. Not going to do you any good. Devendra Hardwar, you, on the other hand, you need to bathe in it because you've got to write about it at Engadget.
Yep. I can't avoid it. My life is filled with boxes and tech. It's crazy.
But I like movies, too, and Slash Film is a great podcast for movie lovers.
Yeah, Slash Film is the website, but Slash Filmcast is the podcast, but it's all at slashfilm.com.
If you go to slashfilm.com, you'll find it. Okay. That's too many things. I can't remember them all. So actually, Slash Film is a news site, really.
Yeah, they've been around for a while, too.
Yeah, that's cool. Thank you, Devendra. Great to see you again. Come back soon.
Glad to be here.
And Mark, now that you've found the way, I hope we can count on you to come back from time to time. Mark Spoonhour is editor-in-chief of Tom's Guide and Laptop Magazine. Yeah. A pleasure.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure having you. We do This Week in Tech every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2300 UTC in Romania. That's the middle of the freaking night. But that's okay, because you can listen on demand whenever you feel like it at twit.tv, or get your favorite podcast app and subscribe. If you want to be in studio and join us, had a nice studio audience today. Thank you for being here. Email tickets at twit.tv. We'll put a chair out for you. If you want to watch live, you can do it on the website, twit.tv/live. But make sure if you do that, you join us in the chat room, because that's the community, people talking around what we talk about. And it's awesome. irc.twit.tv. Somebody was asking me where they can get the Twit mug that I was using, my coffee mug. I don't think this particular mug is available on the Twit store, but we have many mugs, including the now world-famous Steve Gibson mustache cup that is at twit.tv/store. And as we get ready for the holidays, one last chance to help us make our best. There's the store. There's the mustache cup. Do we have other mugs? I wonder. We don't have this mug, though. I think this mug is special, because it's kind of like engraved. It's like carved into the ceramic of the mug. Twit.tv/store. And if you want to help us do the best ofs, our best of will be New Year's Eve, right? December 31st. Yep. Go to twit.tv/best of. We're just looking about for your favorite moments. Give us information, whatever information you can. We really appreciate that help and look forward to a great show on New Year's Eve. You don't have to listen to it then. It'd be your first show of the new year. Thanks for joining us. So we'll see you next time. Another Twit is in the can.
Amazing. Bye-bye.